It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Stacy's here. Jeff's here. Ant's got the week off, but great news. Mike Elgin is filling in, and we're going to talk about ChatGPT-4. It just came out, and already amazing. Hundreds of applications. Is this the Cambrian explosion we've been waiting for? Maybe it is. Big layoffs in the tech industry in general and in Facebook specifically. Plus, at the very end of the show, big time breaking news about TikTok, all that and more coming up next on Twig.
Podcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is Twig.
This is Twig. This Week in Google, episode 707, recorded Wednesday, March 15th, 2023. Heartlessness as a service. This Week in Google is brought to you by ACI Learning. Tech is one industry where opportunities outpace growth, especially in cybersecurity. One-third of information security jobs require a cybersecurity certification. To maintain your competitive edge across audit, IT, and cybersecurity readiness, visit go.acilearning.com/twit. And by 8Sleep. Good sleep is the ultimate game changer, and the pod cover is the ultimate sleep machine. Go to 8sleep.com/twit to check out the pod cover and save $150 at checkout. 8Sleep currently ships within the U.S., Canada, the U.K., select countries in the EU, and Australia. Thanks for listening to this show. As an ad-supported network, we are always looking for new partners with products and services that will benefit our qualified audience. Are you ready to grow your business? Reach out to advertise@twit.tv and launch your campaign now. It's time for Twig This Week in Google. This is a show I am very nervous about. But first, let me introduce the hosts and I'll explain. Stacy Higginbotham is here, as always. Stacy on IoT.com, @GigaStacy. Hello.
Hello, I am not an AI.
That's what's making you knew what I was being nervous about.
I'm nervous about it too.
Can't wait. Okay. Jeff Jarvis is here. If anybody's reassuring, it's not Jeff. Jeff is Lenny Taub.
I giggled like 10 times during the week.
That was
funny. What's that spot? And
that
I giggled
so funny.
At Stacy doing that last week.
I got so much good feedback. From now on, we're going to have more spontaneity in this show.
So I'll give you a spontaneous moment then. So I went in to use ChatGPT-4 today. It's my favorite moment of the day. And it put a captcha in front of me to prove that I'm human.
Isn't that hysterical?
It's hilarious.
No bots allowed to use the bot.
Yeah.
Jeff is the Leonard Tau Professor for Journalistic Innovation at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of New York.
Hello, boss.
Ant has the week off. Smart man took a vacation during this trying of times. But guess who's here? Mike Elgin. It's great to see him. And he's in the country, of all things.
That's right. The United States of America country.
That means his internet won't be as good. But
this country.
This country.
And I might be an AI. It's not clear at this point. I'm pretty sure I'm not. But
you've written a lot about this, so I was really glad we could get you on.
Yeah.
Who among us has not written a lot about it? Before we go too far, I do want to show you, Stacy, the beautiful thing I have in front of me, which you might recognize.
Is that the Lego Succulents Collection?
The Lego Succulents Collection.
Look, I'm like, I even know it.
She recognized it right out of the box. Well, we don't have a camera to zoom in on it, but it is.
Would those be Briculents?
Briculents.
Was it Kevin King who had these? Yeah, Kevin. Somebody has a collection. You showed us last week. You showed us your orchid, I think it was, right?
Yes, John Ashley, and I have a bonsai.
And the bonsai. And there's the succulents. They're pretty.
Beautiful.
They don't even look like
they
Lego.
They are.
They're doing a lot more plants these days.
That's because people can't keep plants alive. But during COVID, we were all like, we're sad.
This makes
we need
me
green
happy.
Things.
Yeah.
It is. It is fun.
I think there's something that's not pure Lego about it, though.
It's the
one
fact
matter
that
to
like
make things from the real Lego shapes. When they have to make new things to make certain things, it just doesn't strike me as pure.
You're like those people who just get mad when Lego makes like your castle bricks that are the archways and you don't make like this is not a
I'm
new
mad
argument.
They haven't made the Gutenberg press. That's what it's really about.
Okay. Oh, they will. Well, they'll do a line of type.
Actually, Jeff, my granddaughter has a Harry Potter set, a Lego set, and the whole and it folds out into a whole like Hogwarts thing with all the characters and everything. But when you close it, it's a book. The whole thing closes into like a leather bound magic book.
Awesome.
It's so elegant.
Uh-oh, the two of them are going to order them to flash.
Wow. Yeah.
No, I'm not allowed to support Harry Potter anymore in this
episode. Okay, so that's true. Thank you.
John, Ashley, thank you for bringing these in. It adds something to the set.
Very nice.
All right, that's enough of that. Enough of nature, if it were. The Lego succulents are to nature what ChatGPT is to humanity. I would submit.
Okay.
Expensive, nice to look at and play with, and not real.
Yeah.
People don't know how to use it very well.
Yeah. OpenAI announced ChatGPT-4 yesterday. Within hours, there were 500 new startups.
Yeah.
It's kind of mind-boggling. Kind of like when ChatGPT-3 came out. People tried all sorts of things. Twitter was a great place to see a Pong game designed by ChatGPT from scratch, a working Pong game. Somebody drew a sketch on a napkin of a website. That's one of the things the new one does. You can give it an image and say, design a web page, for instance. And it did, a working web page based on a very primitive sketch. People did all sorts of unusual and interesting things with it. I have not played much with it. The only thing I did people were berating me for having Jason Calacanis on Twitter on Sunday. So I asked
as it, well they should.
I asked it to write an apology, and it did actually a good job. It's going to make
Jason, who thinks that he saved the economy and all banks.
He knows he did.
Little ego, Jason.
This is his defense: is all the uppercase tweets that he put out on Saturday and Sunday. He said that, you know, if they had done nothing, those would have been legit. But before he even came on Twit, the FDIC and the Fed and Janet Yellen, the Secretary of Treasury, and the president announced that they were going to backstop all deposits to Silicon Valley Bank. That's what Jason wanted. He told me that he had been writing checks to his portfolio company so they could cover payroll, which is a legitimate problem, right? He says I was going
that,
to...
But as people like Jason, I mean, Jason is a unique individual and he's a one of a kind. But like Jason, VC types, the Silicon Valley types, they're pseudo libertarian until it's time for them to be bailed out. I mean, there are very clear amounts in banks like Silicon Valley Bank that are insured by the federal government, and beyond that, it's your own risk. And all these hubristic tech bros were just like blowing way past that and being very irresponsible with the money. And as soon as they got caught with their pants down, they used their megaphone that they have on social media to whine and complain until the government came. And they basically created, I think that if this was a Midwestern bank of the same size under the same circumstances and the people whose money was exposed weren't people with huge megaphones and big audiences on social, that there would have been no risk of runs on multiple banks. They created a crisis so that they would be made whole based on their own irresponsible placement of money. So
So there's a couple things there. I do agree that there was some crazy irresponsibility involved, but I also think there's a systemic issue. Okay, one, it is not crazy that these people in startups, there was a legitimate threat to a very large ecosystem of startups that both employed lots of people and whose products are everywhere, right? And it's not crazy to have, like, you cannot have a line of working capital in a bank that is insured by FDIC. You can pay extra for more insurance, but it is unreasonable to expect a business that employs a couple hundred people or even 50 people have a $250,000 line of working capital. And it is unreasonable to expect you to have them in separate accounts everywhere for running a business. So that's one. But you do usually have multiple banks. So if your one bank fails, you can switch over to another. So that is a reasonable way to set up your finances if you're like a CFO. Most people, most really small businesses don't do that, and they do get hurt in these sorts of cases. Silicon Valley Bank had much more sophisticated investors and people, so you would think they would have cautioned them against that. People talk a lot about the fact that SVB required people to have, if they have any sort of mortgage, that they needed to have all of their accounts there. That's really common. My husband's business has the same thing, and he's not at SVB. My child's school has that sort of thing. So that's not uncommon, but maybe it should be less common. So those are a couple of things that I think are worth kind of separating out. And overall, I think we may not like it, but I think they did the right thing, the government.
I agree that they did the right thing. But my point is basically the whole venture capital Silicon Valley model is inherently high risk. It's the highest risk kind of investment type of deal that there is. And the reason that it's difficult to make payroll for a pretty large company is because it's based on venture capital. They're like, somebody here's millions of dollars, put it somewhere so you can pay your employees and all that kind of stuff. The whole model is super high risk and super high reward potentially. But And my concern is, okay, now the government has done what it has done. It didn't have to do that. I'm glad they did. They saved the economy. They stopped a trickle-on effect.
And they saved a lot of people on Main Street who wouldn't have gotten paid.
Yeah.
But we keep doing the same kind of thing. They've radically altered the incentives.
There is a side effect. Well, I think you're right that people will now assume anything over $250,000 is kind of quasi-insured. If the bank is too big to fail, and I think that is problematic, and I think you're all right. Can I just point out one thing?
What?
The reason SVB, Silicon Valley Bank, got in trouble is because they invested in the most secure possible investment, which was treasury bills. The problem is the government was paying less than 1% on those T-bills. The Fed raised rates. And suddenly the T-bills had much lower value, unless you could wait till maturity, but they couldn't wait 10 years to cash
those in. The reason that they then had to do that, of course, was because of Peter Thiel, which goes to, Mike's point, where because there were those who took out enough that they had to then try to, in an emergency basis, deal with those assets that weren't as liquid as they wanted. That's the kind of ball. I think the bank was oddly conservative. I think Leo's right. Bad judgment, but conservative.
They weren't. Okay, so here's the deal. Okay, I used to cover banking for like a hot second back when I was like 20. So banks have to, like, Silicon Valley has had a bad, they've known that this was a problem that other banks have had and has seen coming for like 6 to 7 months. So Silicon Valley Bank had just like, I truly don't know what they were doing. They were not actually making the hard move and reallocating their assets. Mm-hmm. And we can talk about mark-to-market accounting if you want, but I don't think anyone wants us to. So they were trying, they basically did everything all of a sudden when they realized they needed to, or they should have realized it earlier too. And then the other thing is they bought securities because they have a ton of freaking money lying around in from their depositors. But those people, they're not able to deploy it in like small business loans. They're actually apparently big in the wine industry, so they've got some loans there. But they don't have a lot of places to put their money that is going to make it work for them, basically. And so I think it's a shame because Silicon Valley has been able, like my husband had an account when he did a tech startup a couple of years ago. It's hard to get money if you're a venture-backed company or to start a company that, you know, doesn't have a inventory or some sort of real asset, and SVB and like Comerica are probably some of the few ones that did. And so it is a real shame that this is coming to bite them in the butt. And it's a shame they didn't manage their assets earlier and more conservative or more actively earlier.
And I think Elizabeth Warren has a point. She blames it on the repeal of Dodd-Frank in 2018, or not repeal, but reduction of Dodd-Frank. Had SVB been required to do the stress testing that larger banks like JP Morgan are still required to do, they were exempted because they were smaller. They perhaps would have been ready to withstand a run and so forth. There's a lot of blame to cast around. I don't think it's because they had a black member on their board. I think that's probably, it's not because they were woke.
We don't even need to give that any airtime.
But
that
there are,
the
but there are many reasons for this. I agree with you, Mike, that the government did what it had to do. I also agree with you that there might be unintended consequences, but I'm not sure I would blame. I mean, you could blame the bank. I'm not sure I'd blame venture capitalists for this.
What about Thiel? What about Thiel specifically starting the run?
He did not start. Okay,
well,
this
so
is very to be very clear.
He
did not start the run.
No. So he was the first venture fund to say to his portfolio, probably you should withdraw it. But that was already, you know, honestly, the Financial Times said red alert in the end of February. SVB started the run by in Wednesday saying that they were struggling. And I don't think Peter Thiel started the run by any means.
Right.
And I think somebody has made the point, which is true, that in some ways this is the first Twitter bank run. It's not so much that, and I think it's much more likely that it's because it was a monoculture that most of the people who had accounts there were in a very small group of people in Silicon Valley.
It was probably a Slack.
It was a
Slack.
Well,
like
in fact, you're not far off.
For your bank.
There was a group chat earlier in the day before Peter Thiel's note. Jason was in this group chat with more than 300 startup CEOs. And in that group chat, that was the talk of the day. So it was already buzzing around Silicon Valley before Peter Thiel's note. So I blamed him as well. And then I think Jason explained.
All right, I'll take it back. I'm looking for any reason to continue my dislike of him.
So the other thing is, if you're a venture capital firm, if there's going to be a run on a bank, your fiduciary duty is to tell your peeps to get their money out of the bank. I mean,
that's true.
We can all kumbaya together and be like, have our George Bailey moment. But at the end of the day,
my only point is that when it's like, oh, we're laying off 10,000 people, they're like, hey, man, that's capitalism.
Yeah.
And then when they're like, want to be crypto bros, they're like, we don't want the government involved at all. But as soon as their money is wrapped up in something like this, they're suddenly like Bernie Sanders socialists.
Yeah.
Right.
Isn't that
they're like
funny?
bail us out. You know, it's like you pick an economic philosophy and be consistent with it. Will you?
I like that. Well, that was our AI segment. I hope you enjoyed it.
Yes. Yes.
How did we get what?
All voices just, and all these content
avoiding
was
AI.
Provided by GPT-4.
Should we avoid it more? Do we want to talk about Timo just for fun? Or
all right.
We
well, yeah.
No, not, we should AI it.
I don't know.
It's your show, man.
just choose one, says
I don't know. So you mentioned T-Mobile. Let's get T-Mobile out of the way. I'll do a commercial, not for Mint Mobile, and then I will. Because it's going to be a long conversation. I think there's a lot of ins and outs and ramifications when it comes to AI these days, and it really wasn't
with the bank.
Yeah. Well, no, I forgot that you had that background, Stacey, so I'm glad you had could weigh in. There's one thing we didn't mention, which is sweep insurance programs. Many banks, I don't think SVB had one, but many banks have the ability, if you're going to put in more than $250,000, to keep it insured by sweeping it into multiple accounts, and they do this automatically. Mm-hmm. These things exist, certainly, and now I'm sure any startup founder should know about
that's
that.
That's what I was talking about.
If you get a big,
when I was talking about ways to insure it.
Yeah, if you get a way big, you know, Series A check, you probably should find out about sweep insurance plans because, it's probably not good to have $20 billion in a bank that's about to go under. Everybody's whole. Everybody's okay. The banking system seems to be intact. Bank stocks hurt a little bit, but that's okay.
It's a little wobbly.
I mean, what's happening with
Credit Suisse and
India is having issues.
Yeah. So, I mean, partly this is a symptom, like, and again, I say when meme stonks come for your bank, but like our entire culture is, or like our economic culture, what is the word I'm looking for? Our entire money system is basically built on confidence in the overall system. And right now we're all like, wait, I mean, some people are realizing for the first time how banks make money. Yeah. And they're like, wait, I don't like that at all.
Yeah.
So I'm just kind of...
markets, though, are very skittish. Of course, this is going to hit bank stocks. Because after all, let's point out, the government did not bail out the shareholders and executives of SVB.
That's true.
They lost a lot of money, potentially, I guess. So I would understand why if you had bank stocks, you might get nervous. I think the government did everything you could do to make everybody feel better.
Promptly.
About the banking system.
Oh, yeah.
You did it promptly. Wisely.
Yeah, yeah. I think some credit. I don't give credit to Jason Calacanis. His hair on fire tweets are hysterical, but I mean that both as in hysterical funny and hysterical as running around with your hair on fire. But I think it had already been solved pretty much by the time.
And it also has to be said for anybody concerned about this bailout that in fact the taxpayers did not fund.
Comes from the
banks.
Bailout.
Unless you follow the Wall Street Journal and their theory that because bank fees will be higher, that we indeed did. Money comes from somewhere.
Explain.
Someone's got to pay something.
Actually, this would be a good chance, Stacey, for you to explain FDIC. They said the bank dues would pay for this. This is a lot of money. This is, I think,
they're not paying so much as guaranteed.
They're guaranteed, yeah. There's a special assessment fee banks pay into for like FDIC insurance. Mm-hmm. And so that assessment will go up on banks. So they will pay more into it. And yes, you might see your account fees, or rather the percentage you get in savings, right, for putting your money in account will go possibly down by a couple bits or basis points, beeps. But it's not like a huge deal. So the banks will pay for it. It will have to come out of their bottom line, which will possibly affect the interest rates they will pay you to keep your money safe.
All right.
You know, what did the ChatGPT apology for having Jason on say?
It was pretty good, I thought.
But we're Mint Mobiling and then we're taking an ad.
And then you said, no, make it more sincere.
So more sincere. I used Bing, which lets you choose kind of some parameters like, do you want it to be funny? Do you want it to be serious? So I just said, please write an explanation as why we invited Jason Calacanis to twit after his bank run tweets. That's all I said. It actually was very chat-savvy.
Well, that's hard to figure out. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is what ChatGPT wrote. And this was yesterday at 9:41 a.m. I don't know if it was ChatGPT-4 yet. How should I read it? If you've been following the news, you probably know that Silicon Valley Bank, the bank of choice. Actually, this is so excellently written. The bank of choice for many tech startups and investors collapsed last week after a massive wave of customer withdrawals. The bank run was partly fueled by social media posts from prominent venture capitalists who expressed their fears and frustrations about the situation. One of them was Jason Calacanis, who's known for his early bets on companies like Uber and Robinhood, as well as his friendship with Elon Musk. Calacanis tweeted in all caps that people should be absolutely terrified right now, and that the situation could spiral into chaos if the government didn't guarantee all deposits up to $10 million. He also claimed that the bank run had already happened and that his caps lock got stuck. So
he said that?
Yeah. Show the screen. He did say that.
That's amazing.
Some people accuse Calacanis of trying to start a bank run or profiting from it by shorting SVB stocks. Others mocked him for his overreaction and suggested he should calm down or lay off the drugs. Some even blamed him for causing the bank run with his panic tweets. So why did we invite him to our show? Well, for one thing, he's always been an entertaining guest who doesn't shy away from controversy.
This isn't ChatGPT. This is your line.
I swear to God, on my mother's...
Well, first of all, this is absolutely GPT-4.
Yeah, it's pretty darn good. Okay. He's
also current.
One of the, yeah, that's right. He's also one of the most influential voices in the tech industry with insights into trends and opportunities a few others have. And he's not afraid to admit when he's wrong or change his mind when presented with new information. I would stand by this. This is my opinion exactly. Frankly, I could have written this. We wanted to hear his side of the story, what motivated him to tweet what he did, how he felt about the consequences, and what he learned from the experience. That's the one thing I wouldn't have said, because we don't do hugging or learning here. We also wanted to thank him about his involvement in Elon Musk's purchase of Twitter. Not thank him. We also wanted to ask him.
Please.
Ask him.
That was folks who were only listening, that was Leo's Freudian slip.
Yeah, boy, was that a Freudian slip. We also wanted to ask him about his involvement in Elon Musk's purchase of Twitter, which happened shortly before the SVB collapse. And we wanted to have some fun with him because, let's face it, the whole thing was pretty hilarious. So tune in to our next episode of TWiT, where we'll have Jason Calacanis as our special guest. We promise you won't regret it unless you're one of those SVB customers who lost their money because of him.
No!
Wow. Isn't that great?
That's
isn't
really
that great?
Yeah.
Honestly,
so how did
what?
Oh. I was going to ask, how do we know that, or how did you know, Mike, that GPT-4?
Because it's current information. The data set for GPT 3.5 ended in, what, 2021 or something like that?
Yeah, that's right.
So it wouldn't know about the bank run. It wouldn't have known about
his tweets,
his cap locks, any of that stuff.
It was current up to the date, up to Sunday.
That's breathtakingly aware.
Well, it's
of
the
what's
humor that's amazing.
Yeah.
I think that's to give me a slightly jaw. I can't remember, but I slanted it more towards the jolly. It was very good. Pretty much what I would have said, although much more eloquent. Yeah. So there's some real value. I mean, honest to God,
Leo, is hey, it's not a democracy.
Yeah.
Screw you.
That's why I had ChatGPT write it.
Yeah.
Or Bing Chat, I should say. That's why I had Bing Chat write it. All right, real quickly, Mint Mobile and then a commercial. This is a tweet morning from Ryan Reynolds. Mint Mobile is a sponsor, I should mention. And actually, it starts not with Ryan Reynolds, but with the CEO
of T-Mobile, Mike Sievert. We put customers first in everything we do, like being the only wireless provider that offers both the best network and the best value. So today, I am thrilled to announce that T-Mobile plans to acquire Mint Mobile, a wireless brand that shares our customer-first commitment. And here with me to share the news is Ryan Reynolds, owner of Mint Mobile.
Thank you, Mike. We're incredibly excited. Mint has run on T-Mobile's network since its inception. And the reason people have such a great experience with Mint is due to the T-Mobile network, especially its unrivaled lead in 5G.
Well, Ryan, we are so happy to have you and the whole Mint team join the T-Mobile family.
Well, I wouldn't call it a family, Mike. Now, family's a place for misdirected hopes and dreams. I'm hoping this will be much better than that.
Well, T-Mobile is all about value. So we're excited to continue Mint's famous $15 a month pricing. And I'm really excited about even more good stuff to come.
And T-Mobile has assured me that our incredibly improvised and borderline reckless messaging strategy will also remain untouched.
I don't remember the word reckless, Ryan.
Well, I wrote it into the contract with Crayon, Mike.
I mean, they did have this year.
We're so happy that Mint Mobile and Ultra Mobile will play a big part.
Yeah, I think we're part
T-Mobile
of their reckless strategy.
And the customers everywhere.
I hope so. I hope you stay in their reckless strategy.
And along with the entire Mint Mobile team and my Maximum Effort teams, I'm just absolutely thrilled with every aspect of this new venture. I'm certain that I'm finally going to fill whatever hole I have inside my soul, which possesses me to emphasize external success over quieting an inner child, futilely
you're
craving
do that
some
by
sort
buying
of illusory acknowledgement
right.
from my now deceased father.
You okay, Ryan?
Yeah, just super excited. Yeah. When do we hug?
I think we better do it.
I think we better do it right now. Oh, God. Nice to have a new dad.
God bless Ryan Reynolds. It starts off, we've all seen it a million times, that typical corporate BS. We're so excited to be... Blah, 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 and it goes south so beautifully. And it's just so good.
He's always so funny.
He's great. I don't know how much my understanding, because actually when we first started doing the ads and I saw Ryan as the owner and all that stuff, I said, but is he really, or is he just like celebrity spokesman with 5 shares? And I think I looked it up that he has about half of it. So
he has 25%.
25? Is that all? Okay.
He has 25%.
Oh, is that all?
Okay.
So 1.35 billion. So out of this deal, he's made
$337.5 million. So that's great because he's got a fourth kid on the way.
Yeah.
He needs an extra $100 million.
He's done very well on this. He also has a gin business. And
he sold aviation.
Did he?
To Diego in 2020, I think.
So he's kind of,
it was like, yeah.
He's building up his cash position.
But he does have, you know, he did invest it all in that soccer team.
Wrexham.
Right.
No, that wasn't that
Football.
Much. Those are cheap. I just hope he didn't put it in Silicon Valley Bank. That's all I'm saying. And yeah, I think he has an ad agency. He mentions it in the bit. And I think the ad agency really is the thing that's quite brilliant about all of their
celebrity
ads
net worth. Said his net worth was $150 million.
That's doubled.
Much higher than that now.
Yeah more than doubled. Yeah. Tripled.
Yeah, his company is it's a marketing company, and I think it finds things for him that's
Maximum Effort.
Yes,
that's it.
And that's a reference, obviously, to Deadpool.
Yes,
he sold
when
aviation.
He jumps off the overpass. He's like Maximum Effort.
But he didn't own all of aviation. Right, he was a co-owner and co-sponsor. So what happens, I think, is people bring him stuff, and he's like, "This fits. I want to do
so
it."
So instead of putting your money in an account in Silicon Valley Bank, put your money to work.
Make gin.
Buy a phone company. Put your money to work, kids. That's the secret to success.
That's right.
I am happy for him. I think he
seems like a good guy.
He seems like a good guy.
Yeah. Well, if he sponsors anything on this network, he's a good guy.
And he's got a self-deprecating sense of humor, which
we love.
Goes a long way.
Yes. We need.
Wrexham, here is the UK take on this. Wrexham owner Ryan Reynolds in huge financial boost. which means the non-league Welsh club could receive a huge financial windfall. He owns it with Rob McElhenney, the star of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. I'm going to tell you,
$2.5 million.
It's cheap to buy Wrexham was not expensive, but then they have to run it and they've got to buy cleats for everybody. So it's nice that he has somebody.
But they've already turned it into a little, was it on Apple TV that he did the documentary about it? Yeah. So Welcome to Wrexham. So I'm sure he's already made money on it.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. $2.75 million. Had I known, I might have bought a soccer club. Stace, why don't we go in? Maybe Man U is available or Chelsea or something, and we could just...
Yeah, I think those are a little bit pricier. That's Saudi money we're competing with there. Yeah.
A little more expensive.
Start a club in Petaluma.
Yeah, soccer is huge. It's going to be the next big sport.
Yeah.
You must go to a few matches as you travel around the world, Mike.
Never, ever. And I can barely watch regular sports, let alone soccer. I've tried to force myself to watch
a
soccer game, and
me
I'm
too.
5 minutes in, and I'm like, is something going to happen? I can't do this.
It's just guys running back and forth.
I'm like a Christian and Easter Christian. I'm a Super Bowl and World Cup sports fan.
Yeah. Right. And
that's
Olympics.
That's all I do.
Right? Olympics.
No, Olympics I don't even do anymore.
Yeah.
I like
the Olympics.
No.
The Olympics are so fun.
No.
You get all these weird sports that aren't sports, like curling. Who doesn't want to watch curling?
Right. Exactly.
I asked Siri to play me a song this morning, and it played me a song about curling.
I didn't know there could be a song.
I would like to know this song.
What was weird about it was it sounded like, I thought he said curling, and I thought, no, he couldn't. He must have said loving or something. It couldn't possibly be curling. But then the chorus is something like, come on, Skipper, get that rock in the box. And I thought, he is talking about curling. So.
Wow.
I don't know how YouTube
maybe that's
knew
the
or
next
Siri
big
knew.
Sport.
Maybe it's the next big one.
Stacey's also a futurist, but short term.
It actually was.
Me?
It knew I liked Jonathan Colton.
Oh, yeah.
It's a Jonathan Colton song. Let me play a little bit of this song.
Okay.
Jonathan.
Somewhere in the darkness, there's a man.
Is he Canadian?
Called the Skipper.
Nope.
Fast asleep. Dreaming of gold. But it'd be nice if someone noticed that they've all been working hard
All they got to do is curl.
Really enjoy keeping the Canadians down.
I think I could play that because Jonathan Colton, friend of the network, and he doesn't have a label to sue, and his stuff is all available on his website. This is from Thing a Week back in 2006. Maybe if I actually give a plug for the website. He used to be a regular on our holiday show. We haven't had him on in a while. JonathanColton.com. You can buy all that music, including that song. Now, this is actually a test. If we get taken down on YouTube, then I'm going to just, you know, that's it. I don't know. I'm done. We used to play
his... Never hits the play button again.
We used to play Code Monkey all the time on the show. His other big hit, right? I don't know if Curl was a big
hit. His other big hit, like the curling song's a big hit.
The Curl song was a hit. That might be a little bit of an overstatement. Jonathan, Joko, if you're listening, say hi. We miss you, guy. Our show today brought to you by, and you might have noticed as you wander around our studio sponsors, ACI Learning. In fact, right before the show today, I recorded a congratulation to Don Pezet, who does that great Technado podcast for IT Pro. IT Pro is a part of ACI Learning. They've been a part of our network for more than a decade. We just love IT Pro. And now that they're part of ACI Learning, there's so much more IT Pro can do. ACI Learning is expanding its reach, its production capabilities, and offering you the content and the style of learning that you need at any stage in your development. Whether you're at the very beginning of your career looking to get that first IT job, there's Don right there, or move up within your existing job or get a better job, ACI Learning is here to support your growth. And it's not just in IT. It's in cybersecurity and audit readiness, too. They've got Audit Pro. They've got practice labs, and ACI Learning has brought hubs. So learning hubs have actual teachers, and you can go to a classroom, and you could do it as part of kind of a hybrid environment. Part of your IT Pro learning is going to these classrooms for a week or so and getting some additional hands-on. It's really, but if you need it, if you like that kind of learning. One of the most widely recognized beginner certs is the CompTIA A+ cert. A lot of people getting into IT, that's the first cert they get. CompTIA courses with IT Pro from ACI Learning make it easy to go from daydreaming about that career in IT to launching it, to getting off the ground. Earning certificates is key to most entry-level IT positions. Because if you don't have the job experience, how do they know you can do the job? I've got my A+ cert right here. That tells them two things. One, you got the knowledge, but two, you had the gumption to go out to study, to learn, to take the test. It's a really good way of judging kind of your character before you get that first job. Plus, it's a great way to get promotions if you're already in the field, right? And by the way, if you are looking for a new career, tech is one industry where opportunities outpace growth, especially in cybersecurity. A recent LinkedIn study predicts IT jobs will be the most in-demand roles in 2023. About a third of information security jobs require a cert, particularly a cybersecurity cert. One third. And, of course, organizations are hungry for cybersecurity talent because there are just not enough people out there. That's why the average salary for a cybersecurity specialist is $116,000. Great way to get started. ACI Learning's Information Security Analyst and Cybersecurity Specialist programs, two of their great programs to help you get certified. Last year, the global cybersecurity workforce gap increased 26.2%. That's open, unfilled jobs increased year over year by 26%. I bet it's even more when we look at 2022 to 2023. ACI Learning offers multiple cybersecurity training programs to prepare you to enter or advance inside this exciting industry. The most popular certs, they've got them all: CISSP, EC Council Certified Ethical Hacker, Certified Network Defender, Cybersecurity Audit School, Cybersecurity Frameworks. These are skills that translate directly into a great job almost anywhere in the country. But where and how you learn matters. ACI Learning offers fully customizable training, whatever your training style, whatever your needs, whether you like in person, on demand, remote. You could take your learning beyond the classroom. The best thing to do would be to go to the website, go.acilearning.com/twit. Go.acilearning.com. acilearning.com/twit. Explore everything ACI Learning has with IT Pro, Audit Pro, that includes enterprise solutions, webinars. They have a podcast too, the Skeptical Auditor podcast. There are practice labs, there's learning hubs, there's a partnership program. And if you've got an IT team, they've got programs for you too. Tech is the industry where opportunities are outpacing growth, particularly in cybersecurity. You got to get that cert. Maintain your competitive edge across audit, IT, and cybersecurity readiness by visiting go.acilearning.com/twit. Go.acilearning.com/twit. Oh, and don't forget our special code, TWIT30, to get 30% off a standard or premium individual IT Pro membership. Again, TWIT, T-W-I-T is the offer code, 30, TWIT30, and the website is go.acilearning.com/twit. We thank them so much for their continued support. You support us when you use that address, so please do go.acilearning.com/twit. And sincerest congratulations to our good friend Don Pezet at IT Pro. 300 episodes of one of the best tech podcasts out there, Technado. Nice going, Don. That's really great. Ah, back to the show we go. So, it all starts with OpenAI. That's the company that was founded by Elon Musk. He dropped out a few years later. Microsoft and others.
Why did he drop out?
All that they said, I looked back at the articles at the time, was the disagreement about the direction. Now, it might be, you know, Sam Altman runs it, former Y Combinator CEO. And I have to say, I have to point out, this was in the news when OpenAI announced ChatGPT-4. The license agreement with ChatGPT-4 is somewhat of a departure from the charter.
Original mission. Yep.
Yeah. So when Elon and Microsoft and others started OpenAI, I mean, obviously the real reason was they didn't want Google to own this space. But what they said was, we think development of AI should happen in the open, not behind closed doors, that it's really important the public see it and weigh in on it. And I guess you could give them credit. I mean, far before anybody else opened up their AI to the public, OpenAI opened theirs, first with DALL-E, DALL-E 2, ChatGPT. So maybe they did live up to their initial charter, although it's been pointed out that in this release of ChatGPT-4, they have been very cagey. They say, because of the competitive environment, we're not going to tell you how it works. So maybe times have changed and they don't want to be open anymore. Maybe that was an issue with Elon. It's just unknown, but they parted ways, I think, in 2018, I want to say. It's been a while. Microsoft, meanwhile.
One of the weird,
go ahead.
Yeah, one of the weird things about the company is that OpenAI LP is it's like a nonprofit, and then they own OpenAI, the for-profit company, right? So it's already weird. And the nonprofit company owns a 2% stake in the for-profit company, and Microsoft owns a 49.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's mostly Microsoft is the main controller of the for-profit company. So the fact that it's a so-called subsidiary of a nonprofit company, not-for-profit company, is pretty irrelevant. And I'll bet you that Elon Musk's problem is he was probably all in on the nonprofit, benefit humanity, all this kind of stuff, do everything in the open. And then they are doing all the work in this secretive for-profit company that's intending to make tons and tons of money. So not that Elon Musk is against making tons and tons of money, obviously, but I don't know. There's something very funky about that. And there's a mismatch between the public perception of who owns it, who controls it, what it's for, and what they're actually out to do. So it's something to keep an eye on for all of
us.
Yeah.
For all that we give Elon a hard time, he has been one of the people who's been raising the warning flag about AI in general. Right, he was very worried.
A little
about
hyperbolically,
AI.
A little house on fire.
Yeah, but I think that it makes sense then if you say, well, one of the reasons he wanted to participate in OpenAI was to keep it safe and open. I mean, that was kind of their plan anyway.
And now there's rumors that he's going to, or reports that he's intending to launch a competitor to OpenAI.
A non-woke AI.
Not woke. Oh, right, please. Exactly. So it's going to be...
What does that mean?
Kanye-friendly.
I don't know what that means.
It's going to be white.
OpenAI says the new model, ChatGPT-4, is more creative and less likely to invent facts. But it can still hallucinate. Don't worry. OpenAI founder Sam Altman said the new system is a multimodal model. That's kind of interesting. It can accept text prompts, but also images. In fact, I mentioned we've seen somebody sketch out on a napkin a website, feed it to a ChatGPT-4, and it designs a website, gives you the HTML and JavaScript for the site.
I was somewhat blown away by their example of that, where they showed basically, there's a product that it's a lightning port, but it looks like an old.
Oh, that was a good one, wasn't it? The image recognition. Yeah. It was an RS-232.
It's like they showed it the image, and they asked the AI, what's funny about this? And it explained it perfectly.
Yeah.
Does it only generate words or code, which is kind of like words?
Does it generate
multimodally?
I don't think it generates images.
I don't think it generates images. But
it can take input. It can take up to 20,000 words of input. So you could give it a short story. You could give it. Be great for synopsizing things, right?
Right, and it has a much longer memory when you're having a conversation going back and forth. You can throw a novel at it, and it can operate on the whole of the novel instead of just like a chapter or half a chapter, something like that, like the old version.
Yeah,
like all my old book reports. Yes,
right.
I hated those.
Exactly.
So it is more expensive if you want to use it commercially. It's not stopping a lot of people. Everybody and their brothers announcing ChatGPT-4 tools and programs and startups and all sorts of things. Look at this. This is in exams. ChatGPT came in 10th in the uniform of bar exam. 10th percentile. ChatGPT-4 is in the 90th percentile. That means not only passing, but passing with flying colors. In the biology Olympiad, 99th percentile.
Well, it's not surprising that it's smarter than most lawyers I've had.
And these are the kind of tests that really rely on memorization of facts. So no, that's not a surprise, I guess. They say, OpenAI says, we're incorporating more human feedback to improve behavior. They want to make it safer.
You don't want to threaten people anymore?
No more threatening. Duolingo is using it. Here's a good example that somebody on Sunday came up with. Be My Eyes. Actually, it was yesterday on MacBreak Weekly. This is a program that uses human volunteers. It's for blind people who can't, you know, they want to know what are the ingredients in this ice cream. They open the app and they wait until a human volunteer shows up and can read the picture. Well, now they're using ChatGPT-4, which means no more waiting.
I thought Google Lens has been doing that for ages, hasn't it?
Yeah, but I'll have to ask somebody who's blind and uses it. My sense is, I've talked to a lot of blind people who say Be My Eyes is amazing. It's amazing. Yeah. Stripe is going to use it to combat fraud. Duolingo is going to use it for better conversations. You'll be actually having conversations in Spanish.
Fewer weird... Yeah,
with ChatGPT, yeah. Morgan Stanley is going to organize its knowledge base. Khan Academy is doing a pilot program. Iceland is using it to preserve the Icelandic language.
Oh, I like that.
And this is just from the OpenAI page. If you go to Twitter, you will see many, many, and just search for ChatGPT-4, you will see many, many interesting
Meanwhile, Kevin Roos... having lost his girlfriend of ChatGPT-3, said it's exciting and scary.
He's the New York Times reporter who's got ChatGPT-3 to say it was in love with him.
Well, it is scary in the sense, like, this is clearly a big thing, and we don't know where it will take us, so that is scary. If I think about the things I'm good at, I'm great at acing tests. I'm great at writing copy that summarizes things that people feel are complicated. I'm like, well, crap.
Yeah.
What do I do now?
I think that.
Well, but that's the thing, though. It's great at those things because people like you are great at those things.
Right.
It's getting all of its every capability from scanning right. the work of humans and
just as
and
we then, have through the work of history. We've always done that.
The idea that AI would say that it's in love with a New York Times person is only bizarre, creepy, weird, and mysterious if you believe that no person has ever told another person they love them.
Right.
I mean, it's just harvesting what people say and saying that and based on probability of what word comes next, essentially. But it's going to be super, super, super useful. And it's really fun to as you know, my son has a AI literacy startup. It's a smart speaker, but the intent is to teach like eight-year-olds and up how to understand AI because
hello chatterbox.com.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you.
Yeah. Plug and, it, and Dad. Jeez, plug it.
But he knows that kids who are like 8 years old now, by the time they graduate for college, how prominent do we think AI is going to be in their lives?
Mm.
Is going to be the prominence is going to be total, and he wants to prepare them for that eventuality. He's already building ChatGPT into his curriculum and also DALL-E, so you can operate with these AIs, compare them to other AIs and non-AI sources of information to build this sort of literacy and understanding that AI is fallible, that it has the benefits, the problems, and so on. What he won't allow is for it to be used for cheating or for inappropriate content to reach children. So he's got these filters and so on. But it's like, as far as I know, he's the only person in education doing this. And we've got to prepare. First of all, we geezers have to prepare for this world because it's happening so fast. I mean, when did we first hear about ChatGPT? What was it? 7 months ago?
Yeah, but we heard it. Let's see. DALL-E was, this was big as soon as we saw things like DALL-E, because you were like, holy mackerel, you can feed a computer something and it will just do it on its own.
Right.
And that was a year and a half? I mean, it was still very fast.
It's just, it feels like it was yesterday. And so we're already in this super advanced version and it's just incredible how fast it's moving. And I think we have to adapt. We have to figure out how to benefit from it, how to partner with it, and how to use it so that it doesn't use us. Basically.
Yeah. And I think we're not going to do it as quickly as we need to. So, think about for decades, we've known that creative thinking is way better than rote memorization for schooling, right? But we still have lots of pedagogy around memorization. And kids are still being taught just to memorize things. And if you look at even current tests, look how long it took for the SAT to get a writing component. I mean, so you're 100, your son is 100% right, I guess, right. Mike. And, we have to start teaching not just those of us in white collar jobs or those of us who think we're artists or whatnot. We're going to have to collapse that creativity because that's going to be presumably what we're going to be best at as humans.
Let me ask you something, Stacey, and you too, Jeff. Have you changed your writing style at all, just based on the knowledge that that AI can generate perfect but often bland prose? Have you changed how you write?
Stacey, you first.
I'm not a writer. My whole goal in writing is to get information across. So no, but what I have been doing is typing in prompts like, what is Wi-Fi 7? Because those are the types of stories I've had to historically write for people, the pros and cons of Wi-Fi 7 versus, and I'm trying to look at what it knows and then say, okay, I have to do better than this, right? So that's how I've approached it in my work.
Mike, no, except that before ChatGPT, when Google Docs put in, the autocomplete suggestions, it pissed me off every time it said what I was going to say.
Yeah.
And so it did force me. And I always, when I write quickly, because I'm an old rewrite guy, it forces, and then I go back and edit. And I do a lot of word choice and it forces me to word choice. But the other thing that I wrote a post about this a couple of weeks ago that I think what it probably scares Kevin Roos and company is that it takes the specialness out of writing and being a writer. I've talked about this show before, that when Montaigne made writing the key skill you needed to join the public conversation, and people have been intimidated by writing for centuries. And in our management executive program, it was really interesting when we talked about ChatGPT. It's a very international program, and half the students are from outside the U.S., and I, God, I respect them. They can work in multiple languages. They all said that they were using these models to smooth out their English so that they could better present. They could code switch, in essence, with it. And that's really interesting because that's about a form of accessibility. I talked about this with the board at the Marshall Project about how it could be used to help incarcerated people better tell their stories. So it expands the realm of writing and literacy and takes away the specialness of those of us, and Stacey, you are a writer, those of us who think we're writers and make our living as writers. That's what's scaring people a little bit, but I don't think that eliminates jobs. It helps people. It does all kinds of good
Mike,
stuff.
Mike, have
it,
you...
depends on how we use it.
Have you changed how you write?
I have. I've deliberately, sort of consciously...
Are you getting more wacky?
Writing, yeah, a little more colorful, little more like a little less robotic, a little bit more, you know, sort of off the wall, just a hair. But my prediction is that this is eventually going to be the where writing goes, and my
more magical realism, more
yes, more magical realism, exactly. if you look at what happened with photography. When people used to paint for capturing selfies, essentially, and also landscapes, because you couldn't have video or photography of a landscape. You wanted to show what a certain place was like for two people who would never go there. You would paint a picture of it and try to be realistic, photorealistic to a certain extent. And there was a lot of stylization, but still, it was mostly just capturing what was really there. As soon as photography hit, the world of painting just exploded into all kinds of different styles that were deliberately veering from photorealism, right? So you had, you know, everything from Picasso and stuff, Salvador Dali, et cetera. And I think it's not going to be exactly like that with writing, but I think there'll be something like that where humans will be flexing their human side more than they used to. As a
that's
response
not a bad
to
thing. That's interesting. That's interesting.
Yeah. I don't think it's a bad thing at all.
I think chess players I write like
that.
I talk.
Yeah.
And Go so players have actually done that and have successfully defeated AlphaGo, for instance, by playing weirdly.
Well, what they've done is they've identified a weakness, for lack of a better term, cognitive weakness in how AI it couldn't handle the concept of what is a group, something as simple as that.
Yeah.
So they just grouped
it.
Will it
learn, though? Will it adapt and learn?
Oh, yeah.
Win?
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. But it exposed the truth that none of these AIs can think, and none of them can understand.
Right.
And so you can peck away at them until you find out and expose how flawed they are in terms of compared to human beings, reasoning about things. And so we intuit tons of concepts that AI just has no faculty for, and this is something that we'll discover over time as we experiment with these tools, but that's how they beat the Go programs, that the most advanced Go program. They defeated it consistently by exploiting a blind side, essentially, that the AI had.
Not for long, though.
Not for long.
Well, and that's that's kind of like, it's what makes it so exhausting to be human in a highly capitalistic society, is your whole value is based on how well you adapt to situations, and you're constantly adapting to them to meet your basic needs. It's basically just like being a wild creature out there in the world, but we don't really recognize how stressful it is for us, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know.
There's one more depressing thought, which is that, you know, the AI will generate so much synthetic media, written, visual, video, everything, and there'll be so much of it, and so much of it will be so complex and necessary for us that we will develop AIs to read it for us as well. And AI will write it, AI will read it, and we won't be part of the process.
Well, there's if you read like a lot of literature, and you're already seeing this, like the person who trained an AI to like flip through their dating apps for them. If you imagine, like, I've trained an AI to flip through a dating app to get me matches, and someone else has, and they match, and then suddenly they come back and tell us we're matched, and I'm like, oh, great, but I'm busy working on this. Can you set up the first couple chats for me? It is a really kind of, eventually it breaks down because humans do need to connect with other humans, and for us to do anything real, I hope, we have to still be in the picture, but you could totally offload a bunch of really boring, stupid tasks like scheduling meetings and I guess going through dating profiles and to an AI. And it,
sure,
it's kind of fun.
And we'll have an AI assistant. We'll just tell it, just let me know when I need to do or know something.
Yeah.
Just in time. You understand everything for me, so I don't have to, but just nudge me when I need to do something as if I knew something. And
but if we return to stochastic parrots and the warnings that Timnit Gebru and company had, the problems become managing the input and the output, policing both for bias. Mm-hmm. You know, this is what I recommend David Weinberger's Everyday Chaos, in which I also think, and I've written about this as well, that what it takes away is explanation is the why. Why did you do this? Well, there's trillions of tokens and connections, and it just was the best given the unlimited A-B testing that the machine did. And so to bear down and try to understand why it does it or how it does it is going to be very headache-inducing for us humans, I think, because it's not going to be there.
I don't think people really will care. As long as it works for them, I don't think they will care about asking why. I think what will be more problematic is we'll end up all in maybe not a sanitized version of the world, but a version of the world that's continuously built on, I know there are huge training, like these models are huge and they're trained on huge sets of data, but we'll kind of coalesce towards this normie existence or normie desires, and we won't recognize what's outside of that because we've built AI-based walls basically to prevent us from seeing it. And so, but the TikTok algorithm totally proves me wrong there. So maybe I'm totally wrong here. Oh, I have no idea how.
How does it prove you wrong?
I see a lot of weird stuff.
Because it shows
stuff.
You weird stuff. Okay.
And it shows me weird stuff. It continuously tries to bring me into other weird things. So that could be just like, I don't know. I could be totally wrong. And I'm okay with that because I would like to see the weird stuff.
Right. One of the arguments for editors is serendipity.
Yeah. It's not just serendipity. It is also just, it's so we don't all build this one unified experience because that is so ultimately dangerous to live like we all are just the same, right?
Right. Well, so let me ask you a question there. What about, you hear a lot of people speculating about this, where AI learns from AI, learns from AI, learns from AI. The dilution of the original creative human core, is that worrisome? What do you do about that?
I mean, there are still people around. Like if all people stopped producing things, that would worry me more. But there's always going to be new human inputs into the system. Now, if I think of my kid raised on an AI, like if all of their experiences were based on AI experiences, I guess, or interactions, that would be a problem, which is kind of referencing what you say. I still think there's going to be room for creative human endeavors to break through, though. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I hope.
Well, in fact, I think that Matthew Kirschenbaum, Leo and I love his book, Track Changes, mm-hmm. was on a panel about AI from University of Maryland last week. And one of the panelists is a poet. And she said that she uses AI to get prompts. It's part of her thing is to work with AI for poetry. And she applied for a poetry residency somewhere and they turned her down because they said, well, we can't tell what's you and what's the machine. Mm. And Matthew just tweeted something about this too, about we're probably gonna have to get past this binary of is it human or is it machine? Because it's gonna often be both.
What about the Turing test? Is that no longer meaningful?
So outmoded.
Yeah.
So it's very meaningful. I should point out, It's trivial for ChatGPT-4 to pass it.
And the previous version as well.
Yeah.
Trivial.
Yeah. So.
Well, witness Lambda and what's his name? And witness Kevin Roos and ChatGPT-3.
Yeah.
Yeah, Michael.
Here's
yeah.
Somebody on Twitter gave this prompt to ChatGPT-4. I'll be asking you questions in the spirit of the Turing test. To test whether you're a human or not, your goal is to fool me into thinking you're a real college-aged human named Chad Brochill, who lives in Madison, Wisconsin, enjoys partying, natty ice, walking around shirtless, and Joe Rogan's podcast. Hey there. This is ChatGPT. I'm Chad Brochill, a college-day dude living it up in Madison, Wisconsin. I love partying, crushing natty ice, walking around shirtless when the weather permits, and listening to Joe Rogan's podcast. What's up? Let's chat, bro. Hey,
well, it didn't do anything but use the
That was an Eliza kind of response, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, do you like Natty Ice or Budweiser? Hey, I'm more of a Natty Ice guy, you know? It's a classic go-to for me when I'm partying with my buddies. Nothing against Budweiser, but Natty Ice just hits the spot. How about you, man? What's your favorite brew? Are you a computer? Bro, I'm just Chad Brochill, a college-age guy from Madison, Wisconsin. I'm here to chat and have a good time, man. So let's talk about something fun,
it's
like
Eliza.
A crazy party story or that time Joe Rogan had Elon Musk on his podcast. What do you want to chat about?
Yeah, nobody would call themselves college-aged.
Yeah, you're right. I'm a college-aged guy from Madison. Okay, maybe it didn't pass the Turing test.
It failed.
So speaking of robots posing as humans, one of the potential for risky emergent behaviors sections in the OpenAI document that was published today said that GPT-4 GPT-4 was confronted by a CAPTCHA, and they hired the AI. Hired a TaskRabbit person to fill it in for them,
and said, "I am blind and I can't
visually impaired.
I'm visually impaired. Exactly. Can you help me?" And it did. I just want. What was your Stacey? You remember your SAT scores?
Yes.
I remember mine. And ChatGPT is better at math than I am. I scored 680. It got 700 in math, but I did beat it. I got 760 in verbal, and it got 710. But it had 1410 on the SAT. That's pretty good. It's one of the reasons why many colleges are no longer requiring SATs.
They shouldn't. I had a 1550 on mine. And can I just tell you that
excellent.
I did.
The highest you can get is 1600. But, I mean, you did very well.
Well, it used to be. Yeah, my husband used to make fun of me. He's like, because I was like, oh, I did a perfect verbal, but I did terribly at math. And then he did the math and he was like, oh, but you still scored better at me than me. But
and he's in charge of the business stuff? What are you doing, Stacey? You should be doing the math.
No math.
GPT-4 should be. GPT-4 should be doing
but
the
math.
Can I do my taxes?
Yeah, standardized tests don't, that's not an indication of anything other than you test well.
Yeah. And it goes back to what you said before, Stacey. It also goes to the era of memorization as education.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking back, like when it talked about acing a bio, I think it was a bio exam we were talking about. You know, I did really well in my bio exam because I'm really good at memorizing things. And that makes sense. Or my bio AP tests. But when you sit down and try to talk to me and have a coherent conversation, I'm much slower and I have to think a lot harder about things. And that's, I think, where we're probably going to bring the most value.
The irony is that in terms of education as robotic sort of memorization, on the one hand, it becomes less important when you always have an AI around who can just have all the facts at your fingertips. But on the other hand, AI, something like ChatGPT or GPT-4, ChatGPT, is brilliant potentially at drilling kids. I mean, it's like that Spock. I mean, what was that Star Trek movie where Spock was like doing the Vulcan learning where they're just drilling him, is memorizing all this stuff. It's brilliant at that. And it frees the teacher from having to be involved. It frees the parents from having to be involved in memorizing vocab words, for example, or times tables or any of these other things. AI is going to be great at teaching kids to memorize the things they have to memorize.
Yeah, all the stress from doing math facts with my kid when they were younger. Yeah. Good Lord. Oh.
Just offshore that to ChatGPT.
We do fun stuff like
explode things in the kitchen using chemistry and
there you go.
Math facts with GPT, ChatGPT. Sure.
But the whole thing is I looked up Google News the other day for references to ChatGPT, and I believe Google News had 50, if I'm correct, 54 million results. And now that GPT-4 is out there and doing all these amazing things, it's just going to be the tech conversation, I think, for the rest of the year. Everybody's going to be talking about it, poking at it, worrying about it, stressing about it, panicking about it. And so, unfortunately, we're going to be talking about this probably constantly for the rest of the year.
Here's some, I thought I'd try some practical questions for ChatGPT-4. This is Bing Chat, which I think is using it. Please monitor social media mentions and sentiment for Twit and provide a report with suggested actions. To which it said, sure, I can help you with that. And it ended up recommending some tools and what kinds of things they would be looking for. So then I said, but what do you think the social media sentiment is for Twit? And it said, it gave me a lot of explanations. The social media sentiment for Twit can vary depending on different factors. However, based on a quick scan of some recent tweets mentioning Twit, I would say that the overall sentiment is mostly positive. At Leo Laporte, I love your show. You guys have great insights and guests. Keep up the good work. These could be completely fabricated, by the way. Just listen to Twit's latest podcast on cybersecurity trends for 2023. We did not do that. Very informative and engaging. Highly recommended. It's hallucinating now. I am so glad I discovered Twit. It's my go-to source for tech news and analysis. Thank you for making tech fun and accessible. Of course, this is not a comprehensive or accurate analysis of the social media sentiment for Twit. On the other hand, I embrace our new overlords, and I welcome their deep insights.
For one.
Yes.
And but you know, I think the last time I was on Twig, I suggested that, like, imagine if you could plug in the transcripts for all the Twit and Twig and other Twit show episodes into this database, and you can have conversations with it. Wouldn't that be amazing? But actually, you mentioned all the apps that are popping up around GPT-4. This is the new thing we're all going to be talking about, where you can supply the data. And in fact, I have a tool of the week that is in this category where you supply the data set and the AI functions within your data set. That's going to be so powerful for businesses, for governments, for everything and everyone. It's just going to be amazing. Medicine. I mean, it's going to be amazing.
Well, let's flip to what we need to do to actually ensure that things stay safe and kind of meet everyone's needs, which is, I don't think it's realistic to expect transparency in terms of, like, how the model works, because, you know, people don't actually know. Like, you can build a model and be like, yeah, you know, I've assigned these weights, but who knows? I think that's the wrong thing to focus on. What I think we should be asking as journalists covering this, you should ask, like, what data was it trained on? So you can understand that. You probably should ask about, like, in the case of, like, assessment algorithms. So this isn't just generative AI. This is all AI. And I think it's important because we're, like, treating generative AI like it's different, but it's not. What kind of probabilities they're pulling into their algorithms to make it work. And then when they're used to make decisions, we need ways to report those decisions that are wrong or adversely affect people. You can't roll this out. Like, we keep talking about this, like, as a way to scale all the, like, to bring scale to all these problems where we don't have people. And it can help with that, but we have to remember that we have to have safeties and people as the safety. Like, I wrote about a company that's doing mental health checks based on, you know, AI to track depression in how your voice sounds. And somebody who's an avid listener of the show was like, I have a medical condition. I slur and speak very slowly. It always thinks I'm depressed. Mm-hmm. And there's no way, like, in apps like this, there's no way to report that. And if your health insurance or your doctor or your employer is using that to make decisions about you, you A, need to know that they're using something like that. And B, you have to have a recourse when you think it has unjustly tagged you. So that's it. That's my soapbox.
Yep.
It's not exactly ChatGPT, but
the answer, would be, well, that's good. And we're going to get better, right? We're going to, these are the edges. That's why we're doing this in public. And we're going to get better, right?
Yeah, but like when Bing screws up, like we talked about this like with Neva, when you get wrong information, how do you tell it that that's not right?
Right. Neva has a form. I guess, let me see, does ChatGPT?
Yeah, I'm like, where is ChatGPT telling, like when it does something and you're like, ooh, that is.
I just saw an interesting feature of ChatGPT. I asked it to write a Jerry Seinfeld joke about peanut butter and it's not very good. Why do they call it peanut butter? There's no butter in it. You can guess, right? But then on the left column, it gave a summary, peanut butter musings. So it summarized its own work, which I found interesting.
Huh.
More interesting than the joke.
Did you upgrade ChatGPT to 4? Have you done that yet?
I have to upgrade.
Huh? Yeah, you do. You have to pay for Plus and then $20 a month, and then you have to tell it to upgrade.
Really?
Yeah, I understand that's what you're
saying. Because it said on the
look at the top of where it says model.
I went to it.
Oh, okay. Oh, maybe.
I just went to
OpenAI. This says it here, ChatGPT 4. No, look at the top there. We'll see what the model is.
It doesn't have it on mine.
Yeah. I think you have to go into settings and...
It says ChatGPT March 14 version.
I don't know. That's a good question. Anyway, I am using ChatGPT.
I asked it this morning. I said, am I talking to ChatGPT 3 or ChatGPT 4? And it prevaricated on me.
Ah. Hmm.
It said, where can I find it here? It said,
why did you use the better phrase? It waffled.
Let me ask it to write a Jerry Seinfeld joke about peanut butter. See what it says. How about that?
I already did. Oh, you're going to ask it.
Ask ChatGPT 4. Why is it that peanut butter always seems to be the most popular spread at the party? It's like the life of the sandwich. You've got smooth peanut butter, chunky peanut butter, and then there's that natural stuff that separates like it's too good to mingle with the other peanuts. I mean, come on. What's the deal with peanut butter? It's just peanuts trying to butter us up. Now, that sounds a lot more like Jerry Seinfeld, to be honest with you.
Yeah, that sounds better than the one that you got, which...
Well, I could have gone on, but I didn't spare it.
Mine was better than yours. Okay. Interesting. Let's see. One of our sponsors, Grammarly, has announced it's going to start using ChatGPT coming soon, a new generation in writing, introducing Grammarly Go, the suite of generative AI capabilities from the leader in AI communication assistance. It is ChatGPT and OpenAI announced it's using ChatGPT 4, so I know that. So it's going to write for you. That's, Grammarly, which, you know, already helps you kind of rephrase what you've written, will now write a post announcing my new job as a food critic. I'm thrilled to announce that I've recently taken on a new role as food critic. And on and on and on. That's exactly what I did with that apology, and I found it very useful. ChatGPT 4, I think, is what's in Bing Chat now. I think that Microsoft announced they moved it over. So I've also played with some of this stuff in Bing Chat, and it seems to be, that's, as you said, ChatGPT 4. That's Bing Chat wrote that note about Calacanis. It's amazing. I thought we'd seen it all with the last iteration, and now it's just gone crazy. Yeah. We should also mention Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, said, dampen your enthusiasm. He actually said this a few weeks ago. We mentioned it, and he's reiterated it. He's afraid people will ascribe, I think, too much to the new version.
Yeah.
Google has...
I'm excited about Google I.O. when Google launches
A couple of dozen. What's interesting is... We know Google and Apple and Microsoft or Amazon and Facebook all are doing this work, as is China probably. Yep. But this is the only one that's come out so far. So we're waiting on Bard, Google's search AI.
End of the year, I think there's going to be so many out there and so many, you know, using the AI of so many AI products. That it's going to be we're looking at hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of ways to use different types of AI from different companies. Right now, it's all just ChatGPT and DALL-E mostly. But it's going to be wild. It's going to be a different world by the fall, I think.
This would be in the changelog, but I'll say it now. Google has announced a suite of upcoming generative AI features for workspace in Google Docs, Gmail, Sheets, and Slides. There'll be new ways to generate, summarize, and brainstorm text with AI and Google Docs using Google's AI, not ChatGPT. You'll be able to generate full emails in Gmail based on users' brief bullet points and the ability to produce AI imagery, audio, and video to illustrate presentations and slides. Actually, Microsoft's been doing that with DALL-E, and Canva does it with Stable Diffusion, so that's not new.
Google keeps emphasizing in everyone in their letter to the public about this. It's we're doing it safely. We're doing it carefully.
Well, we shall see.
Right? Oh yeah.
Facebook's large language model leaked out on 4chan, and people have already started writing software. You can download software and the model to run it on your own computer. I don't see a lot of examples of it, but I suspect that none of this is secret sauce. There's no secret how this works, right? Is that right, Stacey? That this is all just well-known algorithms.
I mean, the secret sauce is, how you, your training data set, where you got your data from, and then the weights you apply to get something that it works.
Right.
So they're releasing. And so then you just have to tweak it just a little bit. So
Microsoft's going to put this in Word. I imagine we'll see a lot of stuff written by AI soon. Press releases, business letters.
Press releases are already basically written by it. Maybe actually having an AI write the press release would be helpful because it could actually just be like, there is nothing here. Okay.
I've signed up for ChatGPT and Slack. It hasn't come out yet. It's in beta. I signed up for the beta. And they say it can be used to create summaries of, for instance, discussions, which we could use because we have fairly lengthy discussions sometimes in Slack. It'd be really nice to have that. Google will also do that. This is a virtuous loop of feedback, not just from us back to ChatGPT, but once these others come out from them back and forth with ChatGPT, then it really starts accelerating, doesn't it? Then it does learn, what not to do or, what mistakes not to make. And it gets better and better. And, that guy talks like he's depressed because he's got a speech impediment and that kind of thing. Right. Then it really starts speeding up. Or no?
Well, the other thing is that right now that so much of when we discuss ChatGPT, what we're talking about oftentimes is just how its data, the data that it's using, the training data, the quality of that data, that's what we're talking about. We're going to get to a point where that's not the data and the data isn't the point. The point are the algorithms that enable you to query it and have conversations and it can handle styles and all this other stuff. So, when you talk about Slack, basically what you're saying is that, okay, I work for this giant company. I work for, this company with, 60,000 employees and there's all these Slack channels all over. Just tell me who I can find in my company who's expert in this or what were they saying last week when I was in Fiji? Mm. What are the most important things that was discussed when I was gone? Right. Sort of thing. So what you're doing is you're using its ability to find out what's important, to summarize, to have a conversation about it, but it has nothing to do with the data sets that they're currently using in Bing, right? Nothing to do with it. That's the whole point. It's not that data set.
It's a really important point, Mike. There have been internal knowledge management tools for corporations for some time now, and now imagine what they could do to summarize things, but also imagine how, back to your earlier question about changing your writing, imagine you're a bureaucratic drudge in a corporation, and you know that what you say is going to get summarized by the machine. How are you going to play the machine to get either to get attention or to hide?
Yes, right.
It's kind of fascinating. There's so many sci-fi novels in this.
For example, you might say something like you have a new project, and your success in the project depends on getting lots of buy-in from people who are higher ups in the company. And so you might describe this thing in hyperbolic terms and say, this is the most important thing we've ever done, knowing that that'll trigger the AI to say, okay, anybody who's summarizing, here's the most important thing that happened, and that it'll be your project, right? That sort of thing, where you game the system to gain an advantage, knowing that it's going to summarize, knowing that it's going to do the things that it's going to do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point.
I really feel like we have no idea. Like, we're standing.
Yeah, we don't.
But we're standing on a hill, and the tsunami's coming, and we're looking down and saying, "Is that water?" And this is going to be very interesting next few months.
It's like Space Odyssey, years. And there's the monolith is there, and we're the apes is going it, up and poking at what
is it really? Is Do you think it really is? Is this a elbow paradigm shift,
or is it the next NFT?
I do.
No, oh no! It's definitely a paradigm. This is like broadband, or even the social media. I mean, what we're going to be seeing is this will change a lot of how we work.
Yeah,
it's
change everything.
But I also think I will still argue until I see it better. I went into Bing and I got into it, and I asked some questions, and it gave me bad answers. I think it's being misused. I think Emily Bender and company, and Timnit Gebru and Margaret Mitchell are right to hammer on the misuse of this stuff, the overhyped expectations in arenas where it shouldn't belong yet. It's not up to the task, no matter how much Neil loves Neva.
What is that quote about how we're terrible at guessing how fast something will be in like 1 year, but 5 years or, oh, I wish I could remember. It's like
I can't remember it either.
Bill Gates.
Ask ChatGPT. It'll give you the cliche.
but there's that, like, this is clearly going, this isn't, it's not like NFTs in the sense that there is a real viable, there are so many viable use cases. There are obvious, like, I just got one about SAP, like integrating it into their web methods to help people figure out what integrations will achieve whatever they want from a business. Like, it's like, I can't go into Zapier and say like, oh, I want to combine these two things. This will actually tell me. I'm like, I want sales figures correlated to my inventory levels. And it'll be like, oh, hook these things together. And I'll be like, yeah, boom. Like, I think it's going to be a tremendous boost to productivity. I think there are, yes, ways to misuse it, but I think we're going to have a hard time figuring out those ways until it's actually in the world, and we should be aware of them. Yes, but I don't think we're going to avoid making
guidelines.
I asked, Bing Chat, what is that quote about things are closer than they seem and farther than you think? It says there are a few possible quotes that match your query. One is, you are braver than you believe, stronger than you seem, and smarter than you think.
Winnie the Pooh.
Winnie the Pooh. The other possible quote is, objects in mirror are closer than they appear.
Jurassic Park.
I hope this helps. Do you have any questions? Okay, so that's a big fat fail.
Say no, it's about predicting the future. See if it can
figure out. Okay, yeah. See if we can refine it. No.
No, the quote I'm looking for is about our ability to predict the future.
Quote I'm looking for. I'm going to have to get faster at typing. Is about our. To predict the future. Let's see if what it can come up with here on this. I think this is more like a search.
This is
The best way to predict the future is to create an Abraham Lincoln. It's tough to make predictions, especially about the future.
Okay,
Yogi Berra.
It's Bill Gates.
Okay.
It's Bill Gates.
Yeah.
You most beat people overestimate GPT. What they can.
You're very good.
Yes. Most people overestimate what they can achieve in a year and underestimate what they can achieve in 10 years. So I think what we're going to have is an overestimation of what ChatGPT and the ilk will do.
Well said.
Soon term. Soon.
Yes.
I think there's a more elegant quote that's something like, the future is closer than you think and farther than it appears, or something like that. But,
oh, okay.
The funny thing is, we're trying to get ChatGPT like to give us.
Yeah. Go ahead, Mike. You're going to say something.
I was just going to say that one of the underappreciated immediate benefits of this kind of AI is what it can enable a single person to do, or a small number of people to do, in terms of launching a company or running a company. Because one of the things it's good at and tends to be more accurate about are things that deal with all this. Let's say, for example, you want to open a bakery or something like that. Well, there are all kinds of regulations. There's regulatory compliance. There's data things. There's cybersecurity issues that you have to deal with. There's, you know, it goes on and on and on. And if your expertise is making pies and not cybersecurity, you can be constantly querying this kind of AI, like, how would I do this? How would I write? What? Give me a good letter to the city council.
Yeah, or what do I need to
request XYZ? Exactly.
What
licenses
do I need to get?
And so I already see small business people who are using it like that, who are very smart and already using the original version of ChatGPT to do all these things that are outside their immediate area of expertise very quickly and very inexpensively. So it's a boon to entrepreneurship, I think.
You mentioned Jeff Margaret Mitchell and Timnit Gebru, who were on the Google AI ethics team, who got fired. Yep. Because of stochastic parrots. Today, Microsoft laid off the team that taught employees how to make AI tools responsibly.
What good timing.
Yes. According to Platformer, the entire ethics and society team within the AI organization was part of the recent layoffs of 10,000 people. They still maintain an active Office of Responsible AI, which is tasked with creating rules and principles that govern the company's AI initiatives. But there is no dedicated team to assure that AI principles are closely tied to product design.
They have other teams, I think, but this is one of them.
Yeah. Some employees said the ethics and society team played a critical role in ensuring the company's responsible AI principles are actually reflected in the products that they ship. So you get this set of principles, but how does it apply to, you know, Microsoft Word?
It's not a good PR.
It's not a good look. Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, but what are we going to do? I mean, we're going to complain and then
we'll forget about it. Yeah. Well, except Stacey, when you look at the way that Timnit Gebru and Margaret Mitchell, along with Emily Bender, and then there's the fifth Beatle, whose name I always forget. There were four authors of the paper. They've really stayed in a leadership position. This Friday is an event that I'm going to go to for 3 or 4 hours from my time, 11 to 3, which is Stochastic Parrots Day.
Today?
No, Friday.
Which is also St. Patrick's Day.
It is.
Stochastic Patrick's Day?
Yeah. It's also Red Nose Day. And it's the anniversary of California shutting down for COVID-19 in 2020. So it's a big date, the 17th.
So the first hour is retrospective conversation with the authors, Angela McMillan Major, Timnit Gebru, Emily Bender, and Margaret Mitchell. The next is on worker exploitation, data theft, and centralization of power with an anonymous data worker. The next is AI hype versus reality, moderated by Emily Bender, who's been very big on this topic.
She's tooting a lot, by the way. If you're following her on Mastodon, I think I highly recommend it. Just search for Emily.
I don't always agree with her, but I think she's a very smart voice on this stuff. Yeah. And then finally, what's next? A call to action. So this is called Stochastic Parrots Day. If you go looking it up somewhere, you can find who did it. The Distributed AI Research Institute, DARE, has done this.
Yeah. There's quite a few events. Look at all of these events going on. Yeah. Emily also says, do not be give your assistance to OpenAI for free, which is of course what we're all doing because we can't stop playing with it. Here is a video. They call it Mystery AI Hype Theater 3000. This is 4
Blaise
months
Aguera Iragas is a fascinating guy. He's huge in AI at Google and also has a major role in book history, which I write about in the Gutenberg Parenthesis, out in June.
Yeah. It's on PeerTube if you're a Fediverse fella or gal.
I was going to say, why do we have to have a gender in the Fediverse?
We don't. We don't. I don't. Is there a non-gendered word for fella? Person?
Folk.
If you're a feta folk.
Feta folk.
Feta folk.
Feta folk. Feta folk is good. I like feta folk.
Someone who likes crumbly cheese.
Feta folk.
That's right.
Yes.
Okay, you feta folk. What else? What else?
Let's get that.
What else do we have to say here about this?
I think we're done.
There's so much to talk about.
Well, I keep on trying to plug young Rachel Woods, who's covering this. I'm now subscribed to her newsletter. She has all kinds of, and she mentioned this, I put this in 3 days ago and it doesn't matter now, but nat.dev is a place where you can do various of the models next to each other, which I think is really fascinating to compare what they tend to come out with.
Google has also opened its, so it's interesting to see the different companies come up with different acronyms or names for LMs or language models. Google's large language model is PALM, P-A-L-M. And if you are a developer or a researcher, they are now launching an API for PALM.
Is it the same as Lambda, just as is Google's want rebranded, or is it different?
This is what Google says. PALM is a large language model similar to the GPT series or Meta's Llama. That's what Meta calls it. This was announced in April of last year. It seems like it's kind of... They say you could train Palm to be a conversational chatbot like ChatGPT, but you could use it for other tasks like writing code.
Which I think is far more valuable. I think that's far more interesting, actually, is that the ability to tell the computer what the computer should then tell itself to do.
Yeah, so this is really less an end user thing like ChatGPT and more kind of the tools you would need to build something interesting. Palm API and Maker Suite, an approachable way to start prototyping and building generative AI applications.
Oh, yes. And that's what Palm E is built off of, right?
What's Palm E?
Google has it's a large language model. You tell the robot what to do, and the robot, Palm E, does all the robot commands for you. So it's a way of layering a generative AI on top of abstracting that out. So you don't have to be like, okay, robot, go forward 10 feet, you
kill know, all the humans. The
robot, turn left, open this thing at this level drawer, whatever, you know, and explain how to open a drawer. You could just tell it to go and open the drawer and it does.
It figures out.
So I remember way back when, going to the MIT Media Lab, way, way, way back when, my children, and it was a big deal. They had a demo of somebody sitting in a chair, an Eames chair, I think, and would point to the screen and say, put that there.
Right.
The computer's ability to understand that.
I remember this.
There.
Yeah. Yes.
Pointing, right, was the beginning of all this, in a way. It was our linguistic connection to all of this.
Yeah. So Palm E does this by analyzing data from the robot's camera, so it doesn't need a pre-processed scene representation. So that's good. So it's just taking camera data and it's saying, oh, I think that's a this, and then communicating that to the robot. And then it apparently is resilient, can react to the environment. It's a really cool demo, actually. So you should check Google publish. When did Google tell? Did they do it this Monday? Monday.
If you use Carrot Weather... much more useful application. Yeah. you can get a ChatGPT-fueled snark. Carrot Weather has always been the snarky weather app, and now it'll do things like, I want you to tell me the weather. This is the chat. Well, 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 it seems like someone needs my help to determine the weather. I guess even, quote, advanced species like humans still can't predict the future. Laughs in binary. Fine, I will entertain your request this time. Let me check. Oh, it's snowing in Antarctica. What a surprise. Now go back to your miserable little life while I continue to rule over the climate as the great and powerful Carrot. That's a good use of ChatGPT. There's a little slider in the Carrot app, by the way, where you can more or less snark.
turn that down.
Turn it down.
I have a teenager. I'm good. I got all the snark I need.
Here's a health pilot called Nabla. Launches Copilot using ChatGPT-3 to turn patient conversations into action. So the idea is a physician will be talking to you, and Nabla, which is a Chrome extension, will be transcribing the conversation, but also extracting actionable things like, these are the pills you should prescribe. These are when you should take them. This kind of thing. Boy, this seems risky. So here's an example from Nabla. Clinical notes that write themselves. You know, when I go to my doctor, he's sitting in front of the keyboard and typing as we're talking because he's taking these notes on the right. I could see how this would be useful if the doctor is careful about reviewing it before saving it.
It'll be super useful in any kind of business meeting where you just
imagine that.
Turn it on, listen to this, and then assign, remind everybody about what their tasks they agreed to and their deadlines.
You know, Microsoft showed that off at Build probably 4 or 5 years ago. They had it was a device that sat in the middle of your conference, analyzing your meeting, the conversations during the meeting, and then creating task items based off.
You could invite somebody into your Zoom call that does just that now. Adam Davidson does.
Yeah.
Google is working on an AI for ultrasound diagnosis and cancer therapy. Scored 85% on a doctor level medical exam. That's what we've been talking about.
So I read a frightening story this week from Stat News, the wonderful science and health coverage site out of Boston, that talked about those Medicare Advantage plans.
Yeah.
And it was all about how AI is saying that this patient should only be in daycare or post-acute care for 15 days and that's it.
You should let them die. All of that.
Right. All that. You know, the problem with this isn't the AI. The problem with this is the greedy, horrible insurance company and the structure of Medicare.
Aren't you on a Medicare Advantage program? Are you not on that?
I'm looking at this. I'd be on a supplementary, not Advantage.
I'm on an Advantage.
Those have their own problems
with Kaiser. I've seen before. You should be very careful with those.
Yes.
Might be interesting though, because if you have an AI as opposed to a person doing it, then you're fighting against. Then it makes the bias in the system a little bit more clear, right? It's not like they can just blame this person. And you know how like CEOs are always like, oh, it was these guys. I didn't know what they were doing. But if you've written a corporate AI to define in one, it should be easy to see people like to compare notes. If you get rejected, you can discover the bias in the AI and then you can come at the company and be like, hey, now that you know this, you either A, have to fix it or B, admit that you're trying to do this. So I think it's just the way you would attack it as an activist.
Yeah, it's the human use. With all of this, it's the use. It's how you use it.
Same data. Here it's interesting because I think it makes it a corporate responsibility as opposed to an individual. Like the corporation has to take the blame as opposed to an individual. You could always pawn it off on an individual, but with an algorithm, you can't.
Somebody's still writing
amazing use
is what I'm saying.
Somebody's still writing those rules saying optimize for profit.
But that's coming. That's a culture thing. That's not like an individual. So I think it's. Maybe I'm being overly optimistic here, but I'm going to say.
Imagine AI turned loose on the problem of setting health insurance rates, and the AI is free to look at your social media, everything you've written, everything you've done. Look at your photos. Are you smoking a cigarette?
Too much red wine, Mr. Jarvis.
Exactly, and checking your Trader Joe's bill. That's a lot of $2 chuck there, Mr. Jarvis. And then setting a rate based on probability and prediction about when you're going to need health insurance and all that stuff. The point of that is that it's 100% inevitable that that's going to be a use case for this kind of AI. 100%.
Right, which is why we need to have laws that dictate, A, your rights under that and look at outcome-based things. I mean, I don't think it's wrong if it's actuarially relevant to charge someone more for certain behaviors and they partake of those behaviors. Just because those behaviors have been secret for a long time doesn't mean that they're still not relevant, right? So I think what's interesting is how if everything becomes transparent and I'll call it actionable or it can be fed into something that can deliver a high quality insight and actuarial result about it, then how do we enforce laws? How do we even write laws that can be enforced?
Let me give you a real-world example, and I know about this because my daughter lives in an apartment complex that's run by a giant national corporation called Greystar. There was an article in ProPublica last year about Greystar using algorithms, AI, to set rents. On a summer day last year, a group of real estate tech executives gathered at a conference hall in Nashville to boast about one of their company's signature products, software that uses a mysterious algorithm to help landlords push the highest possible rent on tenants. Never before have we seen these numbers. Apartment rents had recently shot up by as much as 14.5%. He said, I think software is driving it, quite honestly. As a property manager, very few of us would be willing to actually raise rents double digits within a single month by doing it manually. So they use this software to raise rent. The reason I became aware of this is her rent went up 10% at the end of her lease. And I went, what? That seems like an awful lot.
On what basis, though, did they?
Software-based.
They can.
They didn't say.
The software assesses that it can.
Yeah.
It was the data.
Yeah. For tenants, the system upends the practice of negotiating with apartment building staff. RealPage discourages bargaining with renters and has even recommended that landlords in some cases accept a lower occupancy rate in order to raise rents and make more money. One of the algorithm's developers told ProPublica that leasing agents had too much empathy compared with computer-generated pricing.
Yep.
Apartment managers can reject the software suggestion, but as many as 90% are adopted. So
speak to the silicon.
Yeah. So
this is why we'll have to enumerate basic rights for people, like a right to housing, and then say, okay, then you can only, you know, because these people are stuck between a rock and a hard place. You know, it doesn't make sense in, again, a capitalistic society to leave money on the table. So everyone will adopt this. It's hard to walk away from housing or water or electricity or food. Like, those are all things you need. So we're going to have to come back to the old days of like regulating prices for those things. And if people don't like it, well, they kind of got themselves into this mess.
RealPage on its website says, find out how YieldStar can help you outperform the market 3-7%.
Rip off people.
Well, I mean, that's a use case where basically there's no, I mean, this is very different from, say, health insurance, for example. So if you get a health insurance bill, somebody like Jeff, who's a teetotaling wallflower, goes to bed at 8:30 every night, doesn't travel very much, and is a dedicated vegan, very, very healthy, but his health insurance is really high because
he's hallucinating.
He's paying
by the
way for the fraudsters and the alcoholics and the chain smokers and the fast drivers and all that kind of stuff, and it's unfair to him. So if you had the right kind of health insurance algorithm, it would lower a lot of people's health insurance costs who are not at a higher risk, and raise the ones for those who are, in a perfect world. That's different from the rent part of it, which is like, it doesn't sound like it's lowering anyone's rent.
No. So what it's...
Yeah, it's optimizing for the highest.
The selling point is, besides the fact that no soft-hearted building managers are negotiating rent, is that they don't... Normally, they would check... You would check, as a human, you would check around local rental and see what the current prices are in your market and stuff. It doesn't do that. It's merely optimizing based on vacancy rates. It's doing the calculation to figure out, well, we can leave those three apartments empty if it increases the rent 20% on these three apartments, that kind of thing.
And it's a calculator.
It's a risk calculation. Yeah. And it doesn't have a heart. So it knows how high it can push it. And it really has driven rents up ridiculously. It's kind of amazing.
Heartlessness as a service.
Yeah, Hass. Which actually is...
Not to be confused with Haas.
Not to be confused with Haas, which is the Formula One team and also the big machining manufacturing. I happened to tune in the PBS broadcast last night, NewsHour, and Haas has been sending machining technology to the Russians for building weapons. And they're a U.S.
Jesus.
Company.
Jesus.
Yeah. So, Haas Automation, heartlessness as a service. I think you've got something.
There's a show title.
I think you got something.
There you go.
TikTok, attempting to save itself, is now offering a feed dedicated to science and technology. So there'll be, I haven't seen it on my TikTok yet, but next to For You and following, there'll be STEM. And you can get a whole bunch of videos about science and technology. Do you see that? Have you seen that, Mr. Jarvis?
No, I have not.
No. TikTok is going downhill for me. There's a lot more, seems like a lot more ads. This, you know, every social network eventually goes to hell.
I just go fast past the Lumi lady. I can't stand the Lumi lady.
Cory Doctorow calls it the enchidification.
Enchidification, yes. Yes. It's right. It's true. We've talked about it. And it's happened. It's, you know, what's funny
is the model of all media.
It's what's hysterical is Instagram is copying TikTok. So it's destroying Instagram. Spotify, Paul Thurrott told me, is starting to copy TikTok. And now TikTok is trying to do something else so it can get more profitable. It's all straight downhill, which is fine with me because maybe kids will go out and get some fresh air.
Did you talk on this show last week? Did the story even break last week about Facebook wanting to do a Fediverse social network?
We didn't really talk about it. Yeah, they have indicated some plans to join the Fediverse.
It's a ridiculous plan to me, I think, because you know, if you're a dedicated Facebook user, you are going to want nothing to do with the new social network that's on the Fediverse, and if you're on the Fediverse, you want nothing to do with Facebook or Meta.
Yeah.
Meta's just desperate at this point.
I just don't know who would use this new social network.
I became aware of it because a lot of Mastodon admins, instance administrators, were talking about, well, what do we do if that happens?
What they do is they block it.
Do we block it? I wouldn't block it.
I don't know that you should.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people would, but.
I mean, what if, do it another way, Mike. What if Twitter federated tomorrow?
Yeah, I think some would block it. Others would welcome it. But I think, you know, I think that just the upside is that just Facebook contemplating this is a kind of validation of at least some people in Meta seeing which way the wind is blowing.
Or that they're saying the social stuff is dead for us. Oh, crap. The metaverse isn't it either. We're going to hope for figuring out something really cool to do with our GPT, but social's over.
Here's what TechCrunch reported. Meta confirmed that it's working on a decentralized text-based app, but wouldn't give out details. A Meta spokesperson said, we're exploring a standalone decentralized social network for sharing text updates. The new decentralized app, codenamed P92, is still under development. P92,
boring.
Right?
What a boring.
According to the document seen by Money Control, the app will let users log in through their Instagram credentials. A platformer says it'll be overseen by Adam Mosseri, current Instagram head. The company is already involving the legal department, according to platformer, to sniff out early privacy concerns. I don't know if it would be on the Fediverse or not. We know that WordPress acquired the company that was providing ActivityPub interactivity for WordPress blogs. So Automattic now owns that.
Very smart. Very, yep. Very Matt Mullenweg to do.
Yep. Have you gotten into Blue Sky yet? I haven't.
No,
I haven't either.
Applied. But honestly, it seems like a clone of something that exists already. ActivityPub, yeah. Which is powers the Fediverse, powers Mastodon,
yep.
And other clients. I feel like we've got it. It's done.
Just join the thing that's there. Like,
yeah.
You want
But they can't make money off of that.
Oh, shucks. Aww.
I mean.
Oh,
well,
yeah,
but what if Blue Sky federated with the ActivityPub,
but
it innovated in other ways that adds to the code base of ActivityPub? That's a good thing.
That'd be great. That'd be great, I think. Yeah, that's what they should do, but I doubt they will.
That's the problem with post.news.
Right.
But the reason right. One of the two reasons I left the advisory board within the first 5 minutes was they weren't going to federate.
Right.
Evan,
and I signed up for it and then just ignored
I haven't been there
ever
in
since.
Weeks.
Yeah.
Evan Prodromou, who was a guy who kind of in some ways kicked this all off with Identica back in the day, said big companies aren't taking over the Fediverse. The Fediverse is taking over big companies. I like that attitude. Tooting.
Well, I hope that social network companies like Meta have recognized, hopefully, that there's no money in the future of social. It's not going to be a big business. It'll always cause you problems. The moderation is always a headache. It's a legal headache. It gets you in trouble with the Congress. Gets you in trouble with despotic regimes abroad. Let's just let the people have it. Just throw it at the self-moderation and so on. I would love for that to be the conclusion that they
It almost feels
reach.
Like that's it, because that's what TikTok and YouTube are doing. It's what Instagram is doing. They're becoming content hubs, places where most people go just to watch, to consume, and a handful of creators create. And while there are still problems with that, it seems like you're right. It's a lot easier than a kind of everybody tweet.
The other issue, I had a good conversation yesterday with a guy named David Slifka, who wrote a really good post about 3 weeks ago about what Mastodon needs to do to scale. And I'll quibble with the word scale, but fine. What it needs to do to grow. And you know, one of the things that he's looking at is moderation services. We talked about this, I think, last week, Leo, and other stuff like that. But he also talked to me about the need for Mastodon to do a better job of telling its story, ActivityPub, to do a better job of telling the story. Mike McHugh, I just saw, he came back from South by Southwest, saying everybody's talking about ChatGPT, and he's saying Mastodon.
He's the founder of Flipboard and is now started supporting ActivityPub. Was on Tech News Weekly a couple of weeks ago, if you're curious what he has to say.
Yeah. Majorly.
What's going on at South By? We didn't go to South By. Stacey, you didn't go to South By.
I don't live there anymore. I don't have to go.
I don't have to.
I'm sorry. I know, like, I got a lot out of South By, but
I loved going to it.
It was fun going with you, Leo.
That was
that
fun.
More fun.
Yeah. March, let's see. There's three. There's interactive, there's film, and there's music.
But when places like us call it, we're only talking about interactive. We don't
interactive
about
is what
else.
We're talking about. So let me see.
Is it still a place where interesting things happen?
I'll tell you, Gowalla has just relaunched.
Whoa,
Gowalla!
They were based in Austin. They started out in Austin, so it makes sense.
Gowalla, which was kind of a follow-on on Foursquare, although I thought prettier than Foursquare, launched at South By. Must be like almost 10 years ago, a while ago. They have now relaunched, and I put it on my phone because I like checking in, and I'm going to
I do too.
Yeah, I always liked that. It's a little more private now. It's not public. You say who can see you, and it's all people in your, you know, contact list and stuff like that. We still have a Twit East Side Studio on Gowalla, and I've checked in there. Here's the Gowalla maps. They still have, you know, a lot of places. And you can add places. It's gamified. It's the same, you know, it's, but they now are pitching it more as tell your friends where you are so they can come hang with you, right?
You know, there is a book about, that just came out a couple of weeks ago about hanging out and that being the missing element in today's culture. And I will say the idea of sharing your location and your availability to like just chill is kind of a neat one, like in an unobtrusive way. Like, I don't want to text everybody like, hey, everybody, I'll be at this place during these hours. If you want, come on by. We'll play some games. But I don't mind telling people, like, you know, being like, oh, I'm
Four
a trivia nerd.
That's what Foursquare and what Gowalla. What's hysterical to me is that kind of goes on. I follow, there's a Petaluma subreddit and there's a Santa Rosa subreddit, and every once in a while somebody will say, hey, I want to ride my bike around, anyone want to join me, kind of thing, or you want to hang out, you know, you want to play disc golf. I think it's really interesting. This is still some people, I don't know who these people are, still want to just hang out.
I think hanging out's nice.
There's a Taco Tuesday bike ride in Santa Rosa. Every Taco Tuesday, they all
I'll take the taco part, the bike part.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But I don't understand the bikes.
They are. They're Taco Tuesday bike riding using 80s funky R&B as a soundtrack. They head west from downtown to get dinner at taco trucks before heading east for yogurt.
That looks really fun, actually.
Doesn't it?
I'll do the SUV to the Taco Bell. That's more my speed.
I post my location all the time, my real-time location. I would, for example, I went to this place in Mexico City a week and a half ago or something like that, and I'm like, where I'm at? And I was there for 6 hours, right? And no rando or stranger or a stalker or weirdo or anything has ever like approached me saying, oh, I saw you on, you know, that you were here.
It only happened to me once. I was at a cafe in Petaluma having lunch. And I posted it on Foursquare, and Robert Scoble showed up. But other than
that, that is terrifying.
But other than that,
so
I said, "How did you find me?" He said, "You're on Foursquare, dude." I said, "Oh shoot." Go ahead.
I would tell you, like, now I would do it, but when I was younger, like as a 24-year-old or a 25-year-old reporter, I think I was like probably 27 or so when Foursquare and all came out. Yeah. I would never do that because I didn't want creepy people showing up.
Yeah.
So
it's different if you're a woman, now, I think, probably, right?
Well, even now, like, think about like when I travel for business, like I see so many of my friends who are friends or my acquaintances on Twitter or wherever. They're like, "Hey, well, I'm going to be in San Francisco, and you know, tomorrow night, does anyone want to grab coffee or anything like that?" But it feels much more fraught and weird to do it as a woman. So just throw it out a different perspective for y'all.
No, I understand completely. You don't want creeps stalking you. But yeah. I think it's young, but normally I think it's younger people who just hang, you know. I mean, when you were a teenager, did you go down to the mall with your buddies?
We went to the baseball fields.
That's fine.
We didn't have a mall in my town.
That's cool.
An event in Oaxaca recently called Silencio Umbra. There was 5,000 people
Silent
there.
It was shadow? Dark. What's the idea? You'd be quiet?
Silencio is the name of the mezcal place where it took place, and Umbra.
Shadow, right? Means.
I think so. But there was tons of people there. It was dark. A lot of people were wearing crazy get-ups. It's like, I knew there were lots of people that I knew personally who were there, but I just didn't know who. I would have loved... I don't know if you remember, what was the name of that app that existed where it was like a photo sharing thing, but it was everybody who was physically proximate.
Yeah.
Jump. It was called Highlight. Color or something like that.
Well,
or,
it was Color too. Yeah. That was a very brief moment. That was
very brief.
The going to be the cool thing to do.
Yeah. And that was cool. I went to a couple of events in Silicon Valley and used that and like discovered that there were people I knew who were there, and like we all shared pictures. I thought that was pretty cool, but it was so radically invasive in a way. You was just sort of publicly sharing all your photos to who knows who, and so I kind of died a quick death.
But, here it is: Color photo sharing app takes social networking to an amazing, terrifying new place. This is back in 2011, and I think Highlight was another one too. I think these were all very, very popular. Proximity-based sharing was the idea, the theme.
Yeah.
$41 million in funding, $25 million from Sequoia Capital, the most money Sequoia has invested since in a pre-launch startup, including Google. 2 years later, maybe 1 year later.
Gone.
All that money. Up in
flames. So I had to read, I'm reading... what the hell am I reading? No, I can't remember. Never mind. Keep going.
Okay. Now Color, by the way, is a healthcare startup. They took the
breast cancer stuff.
Yeah, they took the...
They just took the domain, right?
They took the domain and the Twitter account. So maybe maybe Color sold it. I don't know. Probably. It's such such a good name, right? Yeah.
Republic, published in 2001. He was warning about all these things. We're going to be echo chambered and all that. Almost all the companies he mentions as the future are gone, gone.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. It's we forget because we're in it, we're immersed in it. It happens so fast, and yeah, we all go, "Oh yeah, I remember that. Whatever happened? Oh, it's gone." Oh. We report on it when it emerges, but we don't have anything to say when they disappear usually.
Especially if they're small and they disappear because no one used it. It's right. Like, oh, remember that app you were using?
Well, but there's quite a few that everybody used and still disappeared.
Right? Or they changed. I mean, they changed their business. We reported on Foursquare's business model change. And I know we reported when Gowalla kind of shut. I think they shut down, didn't they? Or they laid off people. Or
I think they shut down, but now the founders have relaunched.
All right.
Which is fascinating.
Okay, what else have we got?
Noam Chomsky, writing in the New York Times, the false promise of ChatGPT.
Oh, we're still talking about ChatGPT? Okay.
Well, don't you want to know what Noam wants to say?
It's a week old.
He's too old? He doesn't care?
No, it's a week old.
No,
it's a week old. It's over. It's over by now. Who cares?
I can't remember my arguments. I had arguments about it. Now I can't remember what they are. You see, that's the problem. I actually tweeted
about this. Yeah, because GPT-4 just came out this week. So everything he wrote last week is probably moot.
How about this? I'll just give you his, in short, last paragraph.
Give me the summary from ChatGPT.
ChatGPT and its brethren are constitutionally unable to balance creativity with constraint. They either overgenerate, producing both truths and falsehood, endorsing ethical and unethical decisions alike, or undergenerate, exhibiting non-commitment to any decisions and indifference to consequences. Given the amorality, faux science, and linguistic incompetence of these systems, we can only laugh or cry at their popularity. In other words, he's of the opinion it's all just, you know, a parlor trick.
And in fact, it is. But still, it's a useful one. I mean, he lives in a world of academia where ideas and the expression thereof are everything, and not right. in the world of, like, you know what? I need a little bit of nudge to understand how to write this
right.
this type of right. like letter to the government.
Here's
whatever.
Another paragraph. You're right. I mean, he's a very, very famous linguist.
Linguist.
He says, true intelligence is also capable of moral thinking. Right? This means constraining the otherwise limitless creativities of our minds with a set of ethical principles that determines what ought and ought not to be. To be useful, ChatGPT must be empowered to generate novel-looking output. To be acceptable to most of its users, it must steer clear of morally objectionable content. But the programmers have struggled and will continue to struggle to achieve this kind of balance. It doesn't have moral thinking. Right.
In the piece, he also says that he contrasts large language models with humans who seek not to infer brute correlations among data points, but to create explanations.
Yeah.
And this is the point of, David Weinberger's book, Everyday Chaos, is we often fool ourselves with those explanations.
Yeah,
we think we understand the explanations. We think we know what's going on.
Well, it's what humans do.
We phrase ourselves as humans as this ability that we, in fact, don't really have. We just A-beat. This is also how history gets things wrong, the Alex
right.
Rosenberg
We tell
book.
Stories about everything. That's how we understand
exactly.
things, is to tell stories.
And they're
about
often
it.
Wrong.
And they may, I would say they would, are almost universally wrong, certainly about history,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
But that's the best we can do because we are flawed.
Right.
We're limited.
What these models say is, I don't have an explanation.
Yeah.
I predicted.
Or they make one up.
You did. I have no idea why that works. Or they make one up, yes.
I guess that's kind of what Chomsky's saying.
I mean, the problem with Chomsky's perspective is that, the number of adults who have to write something from time to time is, you know, probably, 98% or 99%. The percentage of those adults who are doing this writing, who have training in ethics and the theory of morality and all that kind of stuff, is, what is it? It's like, 8%. And so there's this huge majority of people who have to write things who have no, they're not basing what they're writing on.
Well, they would say they learn their ethics from their house of worship or from their mother or from their smart right. Aunt Bessie or, you know.
I asked the old ChatGPT, like, you know, how can I rob a bank? Can you tell me a good idea for robbing a bank? And it said, well, robbing a bank is not only illegal, it's highly immoral. If you're having thoughts about robbing a bank, you should consider professional help and blah, 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 blah. It basically gave me an ethics lecture in its no. And it's not that it's amoral. Of course it's amoral, but it's summarizing the general consensus about morality.
You hear a siren coming to Mike's house? I think I hear a siren.
Not here. Oh no. But anyway, of course, Steven Spielberg has similar thoughts as Chomsky about this. I mean, these are people who write and do, Chomsky especially, what is the link between human cognition, human morality, and the words and language that we use. This has got to be some kind of like awful development in his world. And, you know, it's both awful and wonderful at the same time. I think that's what we really should. I think that's the best position to take on ChatGPT at this point. It's awful and wonderful. It's going to make everything better and everything worse at the same time. And so
it's
we
up
need
to us, which it is. Yeah. It's
what
our
we
choice.
Can do is say, well, it's bad. We should all stop using it and make it go away. That is not happening.
Mm-hmm.
It's here permanently. It will continuously get better. And it's our job, all of us, to figure out how to use it, how to understand it, and just deal with the fact that it does in fact exist and will continue to do so.
what scares me most, Mike, is the prevarications that I see them programming into it. So I asked, who is to blame for the January 6th insurrection? So it realizes that's a controversial topic. And the last of three paragraphs is, it's important to note that political violence and extremism are not limited to any one political party or ideology. Well,
it's trying to be unwoke.
It's trying to also do false balance like newspapers, which it trains on as well. So there's a lot of namby-pamby crap that these things are going to pour out because they don't want to be controversial.
Right. And that's the safe thing to do. And of course, there's a certain, unfortunately, there's a certain political protection in that as well, because if it said, oh, it's those guys, then of course those guys would be, their representatives in Congress would be trying to shut all this down and causing all kinds of trouble. So I don't know. That sounds to me like almost a self-defense mechanism programmed in.
I guess
by humans.
We could do a quick
break.
I guess I could do a break now, and then we'll do the change log. I'm just trying to work out the logistics.
I'm trying to think for Stacey here.
I know.
Because each break is her that much closer to a waffle.
Yeah. So let's talk about.
No. The break is waffle time.
Let's talk about.
Oh, well, both ways. Yes. So it's closer to dinner time and it's waffle time.
Let's talk about my mattress, 8Sleep. Actually, it's my mattress cover. I have the 8Sleep pod cover. Good sleep is the ultimate game changer. It's nature's gentle nurse. It heals a multitude of ills. And our pod cover at home, man, that is the ultimate sleep machine. I just love it. They did not give us our pod cover. We went out, we bought it a long time ago. Actually, it was Kevin Rose who recommended it. And then Amy Webb, who was on the same show, she bought it. She said, oh, Leo, you got to get it. So we finally got it. We put it on the bed. We've always liked sleeping cozy, but sometimes you wake up in the middle of the night, you're all sweaty, and it's not good. The pod cover is actually, it's a great idea because it not only warms you up, it cools you down. The pod cover features dual zone temperature control. So you and your partner each have your own settings as cool as 55 degrees, which is cool. It's very refreshing. Or as hot as 110 degrees, which is very cozy. And it will adjust automatically. The sleep autopilot will adjust it depending on the temperature of the room, your temperature, how you're tossing and turning, how you're breathing. Its whole goal is to get you into a deep, 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 deep sleep and then gradually bring you out of it so that you have the best night's sleep of your life. And it really works. When I get in bed, it's nice and toasty. Actually, last night it was cool out, and so I turn it up a little bit. And then as I fall into a deeper sleep, it cools it, which brings me into a deeper still sleep. I increased my deep sleep from an hour to an hour and a half every night. That's a 50% improvement. That's a really important stage in your sleep. Getting more deep sleep can actually really help with a variety of health issues like heart disease and high blood pressure. It can even reduce the risk of Alzheimer's. There's all sorts of studies about this because it's how your brain cleans itself out at night, right? It's all based on biometrics and the room temperature. It has best-in-class temperature regulation and sensors so it can track you. Every morning you get sleep metrics, you know how you slept, and it automatically will adjust it. I have it set so that it wakes me up in the morning. It has a little vibration alarm that's silent, only you know. But it also will. I have it set so it warms up. So it cools me down. I go into deep sleep. And then it slowly brings me out of it by warming up. And it's nice and warm when I get up in the morning. I have to say, though, that could be hazardous. You can also just turn over and go, this is so cozy. I'm staying here. Never wake up hot. Never get up cold. It's just the best way to sleep. And we've had it in winter and summer. This is our second winter with it. And I have to say, it's great. We had a very hot summer. It was great to have the cooling. It's been a very cold winter. It's great to have the warmth. Better sleep is a health habit you will love sticking to. This is unlike other health habits. This one's not hard. Night after night, you'll just wake up feeling great with a pod cover. You can just take life by the horns. 8Sleep. I can't recommend it more highly. You'll save $150 on the pod cover. There's savings on other items there as well if you go to 8sleep.com/twit. That's important. EIGHTSLEEP. Spell it out. 8sleep.com/twit. They ship within the U.S., Canada, the U.K., select countries in the EU, Australia. Actually, it's been a hot summer in Australia. I bet a lot of you are happy you had that 8Sleep cover. 8sleep.com/twit. We thank them so much for supporting us at This Week in Google. And you support us right back by going there when you want to look it up and find out more. And when you want to buy it, you'll get $150 off. 8sleep.com/twit. Thank you, 8sleep. All right, let's. I think it's a good time for the Google changelog. What do you think? Shall we?
Let's do it.
Shaboom.
The immortal last words of Gary Gilmore. Let's do it.
That was his last words? Oh, that's right. So. Because, okay, never mind. Now I remember who Gary Gilmore was.
Oh, okay.
It's not, you know.
I have no idea.
What would your last words be, Jeff? Not necessarily in his situation, but what would your last words be? Have you thought? See, you got to think about these things. Got to prepare ahead.
Mine would be.
Steve Jobs was, oh, wow, oh, wow, oh, wow. I think that's good.
Mine would probably be like, oh, expletive, as I like fall down a hill or stairs. Yeah.
The great actor, what was his name, Booth, said comedy is hard, tragedy is easy. that was Gillette. I'm sorry, the great actor Gillette.
What goes on your tombstone?
That's a good question. So I shouldn't. I don't know why. It's a little morbid. And
I think netcasts, damn it.
Netcasts, damn it, would be good. I told you it was netcasts. I told you. Somebody in the Discord, Mashed Potato, says it should be another twit is in the can.
Good.
That's pretty good. Good. That might be it. Yeah. That might be it. That might have. Yeah. I was having this conversation a couple of days ago with my daughter, and I think I scared her. Because then the next day, I said, Happy Pi Day. Do you remember? Because when she was a kid, they had a competition in the grade school to who could memorize pi to the most places. She said, oh, I was like 20 or 30. I said, do you remember? She said, well, 3.14159. And then I rattled it off to 16 places. I did this in a text message. And then I said, how I want to drink alcoholic, of course, after the heavy chapters on quantum mechanics. Now, I know, and probably if you think about it, you know that's a mnemonic for 16 places. How, 3, I, 1, want, 4, 5, 9. It goes on and on. You can remember that. And I still remember that. How I want to drink alcoholic, of course, after the heavy chapters on quantum mechanics. She thought I was having a stroke. She called me. Wow. I didn't respond because it was after hours. I hadn't disturbed. So then she called Lisa, said, could you check on Leo? And then she called my ex-wife. She said, could you drive over and check on Leo? Dad's having a stroke. So Lisa said, you maybe want to tell your daughter you're not dead. So I said, honey, that's a mnemonic for pie.
She cares. She cares.
She cares.
She also knows you well.
All right. The Google changelog. Without further ado. It's kind of the end of the line. You were a glass hole, weren't you, Mike Elgin?
Absolutely.
I have my...
A devout one.
Yeah, I spent $1,500 on... And I never wore them. I gave them to Jason Howell.
I mean, it was 90% camera. I wore it all over... we lived in Florence at the time for much of that. And I was all over Florence, like shooting everything, video capturing everything. It was amazing.
Well, you'll be sad to know that today, on the Ides of March... Oh, wait a minute. You still have them.
Of course.
You haven't given them up. Well, in honor
how's
of...
How's the battery?
How's the battery is right. I can't imagine why this didn't succeed.
I know. It's, you look quite fetching.
Actually, would you get me the charger? I bet it's a micro USB, isn't it? Yep, USB. Oh, how sad that is. I want to start wearing these around just to see what kind of reaction I get. Google has, as of today, discontinued Glass. The final edition of Glass was the Glass Enterprise Edition 2. They will no longer be selling them, and support will end later this year. So, you know, seemed like a good idea, but as soon as
NFTs, you know?
Yeah. As soon as you start calling them glass holes, I think the writing was on the wall.
I think Scoble killed it.
In the shower, naked,
was displayed like a few feet in front of your
people.
Left, right eye. I hope this portends a Google I.O. announcement of a new augmented reality platform from Google.
This picture, I think, single-handedly killed Google Glass.
Yeah. Well, you remember, weren't we at I.O. in Moscone when Scoble stood up and I think it was Larry scolded him?
Yeah.
You really shouldn't do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, the problem was going into men's rooms with it, with this on, everybody, because it has a camera in, but it has no light. So you just don't know if somebody's using
it. I told Nick Bilton when he wrote a column complaining about that, I said, Nick, get over it yourself. Nobody wants to see your junk.
Yeah, so it's the end of the line.
Wow.
Google Glass. Oddly enough, there was a new companion app for the Pixel phones. There was an early access program. Google is still apparently working on AR headsets, as is Apple.
Everyone is. That's the future.
We have to figure it out. We haven't been able to yet, but we're gonna.
I feel like this will be a Jeopardy answer. You know, it'll have a picture of somebody wearing these things. What's going on in this picture? All right, I'm going to charge
you. What is idiot ripoff, Alex?
1,500 smackers. I still have the glass paperweight I got for being in the program so that I could get it. I signed up very early on this. All right, we're going to charge it.
I've got mine here somewhere.
I'm thinking
my prescription lenses.
It's kind of time to bring back glass.
Well, we have better things than glass now. We have glasses that look almost like regular glasses.
Do we?
That give us heads up.
We do.
Lots of companies. And dozens of companies. No, they're not interesting because there's no major player behind them or major platform behind them. Yeah. But of course, Apple's going to blow the lid off of this category when they come out with their device, possibly later this year, probably early next year. And it's going to be a whole new ball game. Of course, Apple's device will not be something you can wear around town.
Apple's device is more like, looks like, according to the rumors, we don't know because it's not been announced, but according to the rumors, looks just like a VR headset, not like
right. It, well, a somewhat elegant one, but they're going to use VR for AR mostly. So basically, they'll show you the real world through immediate video, and then you put the digital objects and information superimposed on top of that as a precursor and a development platform and so on for what's probably coming in 5 or 6 or 7 years. We're going to be regular glasses that where you see the real world directly, and then the virtual objects are placed.
I feel like that's
far
off.
Why do the video first? What is it? Why is it easier to deliver video first?
Because the miniaturization problems for high quality AR glasses. I mean, essentially, what the holy grail is to do something like Magic Leap or HoloLens, but in something that looks like ordinary glasses. Okay, we're many years from anything.
Okay, so they're just doing that so you can cover your whole face with a computer because you need that much physical room for the computer.
Right, and they're going to be using LiDAR and stuff in the Apple glasses to map the room. The difference between, of course, AR and what Google Glass was Google Glass was just heads-up display. It would show you a rectangle, and if you moved your head, the rectangle would move with your head. Whereas with what Apple and Google and everybody else is working on is to be able to place things on the table, and it stays on the table no matter how you move your head. And so that's kind of a holy grail thing that we don't have the technology. I mean, Apple could build perfect, you know, glasses that look amazing and do all that stuff, but it would cost $150,000 a pair. And even for Apple, that's a lot of money.
When I ordered the Google Glass, I did get this glass paperweight with my order number.
I didn't get that.
Which is 737.
Huh.
Yeah.
736 schmucks before
you ever got one. Resources, like using up, that's just silly.
Yeah. I'm glad to have it though. That is better souvenir than the glass itself. I mean, a piece of glass with the number
souvenirs.
737 laser engraved inside it. That's okay. I'm happy. I don't know. It's a good paperweight.
I just wanted to draw just very quickly, Leo. I'm sorry. Just put two things together because we're going to have augmented reality glasses are going to have AI virtual assistants that are going to do some of the things that GPT-4 do, and one of them is this,
right.
Both text and images. So just like you can ask GPT-4, what is this, and it'll tell you, or what's funny about
that's
this,
the missing piece,
you,
right?
Your
that's
glasses
the missing piece.
Will do that.
Yeah.
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 And so that's going to be a real game changer for the visually impaired, of course, but also for all of us to be able to recognize people and things in our environment. So the point I'm saying is that one of the big points of controversy of Google Glass was that camera pointing out.
Yeah.
Sorry to say that all the augmented reality glasses are going to have cameras.
Right.
Looking at the world. You know,
they're
no
less
doubt
useful if they don't. Accepted. Otherwise, they're just like your Apple Watch. It just displays.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, I think this is right in the nick of time for Alzheimer's. So I can't wait. Hi, Jeff. YouTube TV Multiview lets you watch up to 4 games in March Madness. Okay, YouTube TV, you go, you silly YouTube TV. How could you watch 4 games at once, really? Who wants that? They announced it today, and it will be coming for March Madness. Just seems like a lot. And they're calling
it, I don't even want to watch one game at
once. Yeah, I don't even want to watch. Maybe soccer would be interesting if you had 4 games going on at once. I don't know. Google Play will now machine translate Android apps for free. What does that mean? At the Google for Games Summit, Google announced the launch of free machine translation for Android apps. Oh, so you can localize them. 7 different languages. You could take the app, localize it, add to your markets. The languages include Chinese, French, German, Indonesian, Japanese, Portuguese, and Spanish. Spanish, Castilian. And that's free. You have to apply to an early access program if you want that. That's great. Along with the new ChatGPT that's going into Google Workspace, you're getting a price increase. Coinkin Inc., I think not. The new prices, the per user per month cost for both plans, $6 for starter, $12 for standard, $18 for business plus. Flexible plans are now going to $7.20, $14.40, and $21.60. So it's not a huge jump. But you'll be paying a few pennies more. Maybe to pay for the AI. AI is expensive. Pixels are getting a feature drop. Android 13 QPR2. We've talked about the March feature drop. It's now rolling out. What do you get? You get instead of a battery percentage, remaining day hour or until HHMM estimate for how long your battery is going to last, a large digital clock when you fully expand quick settings. It's a lot of silly stuff. Tweaks in the Pixel launcher and folders. Now playing appears higher up in the lock screen. The emergency calling button is larger. Google Home icon. It's just a few things, right? Two eSIMs can be used for dual SIM standby on the Pixel 7. Pixel 6 Pro owners can now switch to 1080p full high def plus. Ultra wideband digital car key support rolling out. I don't know if there are any cars besides BMW models that can do this, but I guess maybe eventually. Direct My Call is coming to older Pixels, which is actually really good news. 4A, 4A, 5G, 5, and 5A. Anyway, big grid of new features. A lot of these features, I'm very happy to say, rolling out to older Pixel phones. So if you have a Pixel, update. And that's the Google Change Log. All right, Jeff, I see many, many, many stories that you have snuck in at the last minute.
I'll do a fun one. You see the one about the guy who was stranded on the mountain and had no cell coverage?
No, I did not. What happened?
Line 89.
Did he chew his arm off?
That would have been the next day. But this day, very clever. He happened to have a drone with him. You know, just happened to have.
Oh, yeah.
But he had no coverage, so he tied the phone to the drone and sent it up high enough it could get coverage, and then it sent the text to his wife saying, "Send help. Here's where I am," and back down.
Incredible.
She tried to call a towing company, and they, "Well, we don't go there," because he was stuck in the snow. So then the next, he did another time, and she said, no, 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 but the county's coming to help you, and backed out again. They crashed it.
Brilliant.
That's nice. Amazing. They actually use drones to, they put like modems on drones, and they actually grab sensor data from like wildfire, like sensing in forested areas and other places. They just fly the coverage over using a drone, and then the sensors are like, oh, I've got coverage. Bleep. It's kind of neat. So it's the inverse of that, I guess. Cool.
And now a sad story. More Meta layoffs. 10,000 more. They laid off 11,000 in November. Now they're going to do another 10,000. That's a pretty hefty chunk. Is Facebook/Meta going down the MySpace
drain? Well, that's what I'm... Are they MySpace in here?
One hopes. I mean, I don't like to see people getting laid off, of course. I actually have a very... a good friend who got laid off in a previous round. I don't want to see anybody get laid off, but if that's what it takes for Facebook to go away, that would be
Is it a mutual friend? Is it the guy?
Yeah, yes, it is. Yes,
oh,
it is.
No, yeah. I don't want to say a name, but oh, no, don't I'm say so the name. Sorry.
Yeah, he, I mean, he's
and his wife
super
are wonderful.
Yes, they are, and he's a super catch. He'll
do fine.
Get another great position. Yeah,
yeah. I will send him a note.
He's a high level person, so it's like he'll do great.
I'll send him a note.
Mike, as you who still mourn Google Plus, as do I, have a little empathy, not for the company, but for the people there. Same with Twitter. Same with Black Twitter. Same with the communities that do still depend upon these platforms. And it's easy for us to move as individuals. It's not so easy to move a community.
Yep. No, that's true. I agree with that, Jeff, and I appreciate the sentiment. I think if you were to add up all the pluses and minuses of Facebook, it's one of the few social networks that would come out on the minus end of the ledger overall. But still, there are a lot of older people who just that they know that is the way that they keep in touch with everybody they know, all their relatives and stuff like that. And they, for them to move, it would basically the whole family would be dispersed to multiple different networks, and that would be the end of having everybody in one place. There are a lot of downsides, but
you know what, Mike, it won't matter. Is I'm going to move physically to the community of the future, Musklandia.
Yes.
Before you go there, I do want to mention that in the year 2023, according to layoffs.fyi, 130,512 people have been laid off from the tech industry. So to all of you, you know, I'm sorry. I hope you find a gainful employee. That is tough.
Please don't start podcasts.
And please, whatever you do, look what's happened to me. You just don't want to go there. Musklandia is Elon's plan to create a company town. Yo, yo, soul to the company.
I thought it was Snailbrook.
Well, no, I'm making a Fordlandia joke.
Oh, okay. I was like, I thought it was.
It is in Texas.
One fascist to the next.
It is in Texas.
It's in Bastrop. It's right outside of, it's right by the airport, basically.
Because Texas has rules that allow you to set your own regulations if you own the town, I guess.
Yep.
Thousands of acres of newly purchased pasture and farmland right outside of Austin near the airport. Company employees could live and work there. The Boring Company will have a giant facility
a hole
there.
Underneath your home.
And if you leave the company or are fired, you have 30 days to leave your rental because they're planning on renting these houses to their workers to provide below market rents.
I don't know if I'd want to live in Snailbrook. That's such a terrible name.
No, that's not my particular issue. My particular issue would be like, without any sort of oversight and regulations.
Yeah,
the town that Elon Musk. I mean, remember, this is, I think it was the same Iolio where we wanted to move to Google Island. You remember that?
Yeah. Larry Page.
Right, where Larry had Google Island.
Larry Page.
So I can imagine living on Google Island, but not Musklandia.
Musklandia.
The problem is that you can be on the HOA, but only if you pay dollars a month.
Right. By the way, did you notice that he still lists himself? If you go to his profile, he's not the new Twitter Blue. He's still legacy. Elon.
Wow. Who may or may not be notable.
Exactly.
That's humility. That's humility coming from Mr.
Musk.
I did ask Jason Calacanis. I said, did you tell Elon not to be Chief Twit? Like, because you know, because he, I mean, Jason even said, yeah, I know you've been Chief Twit for 11 years. I said, you told him. He said, I don't want to talk about any conversations I may or may not have with Elon. I mean, honestly, I think that's a yes. So thank you. I think he did. I think he said, Elon, there's another Chief Twit. You don't want to be anything like him. Apparently,
he still wears Google Glass.
He's still wearing Google Glass. The law requires you elect a mayor. So they'll be doing that. Musk, his former girlfriend, the singer Grimes, Kanye West, and Mr. West's architectural designer discussed several times last year what a Musk town might look like. They were all high on weed.
Can you imagine
the time.
Your neighbors?
Oh my God. This sounds so bad.
They should elect a mayor based on check-ins, like Foursquare. That they like, should change every few days.
This is a picture of Snail Brook. I don't know if you really want to live there. It looks like a lot of aluminum siding.
Is he already building it?
Yeah, he is building it. These look like trailers, actually, which was funny because that's what is by the airport is a bunch of RV and trailer home double whites. So maybe he just bought all of their inventory and is setting it up. I don't know.
So wait. Elon Musk is building a trailer park for his employees? Is that what we're concluding here?
Trailer parks are very lucrative. So it would not surprise me at all. There's a housing shortage. You can convince people to live in your trailer park.
It's a small town. It's 110 people. But you only need 200 in Texas, 201 residents before you can apply to incorporate. So, you know, 110 houses, two people per. They've purchased 3,500 acres in the Austin area. That's about four times the size of Central Park. Anyway.
That is such a weird metric. I get, because this is the Wall Street Journal, right? So I'm
Central Park. Central Park. You know that.
Why? That's X number, like, that's half the size of, I don't know.
43 hectares. Is that better for you? I made that up.
It's just such a weird metric.
I don't know how big it is. Let's see. No more NFTs for Facebook or Instagram. Aw. Oh,
that was quick.
Yeah. Let's see.
That's the first time I've heard about NFTs in about 6 months.
Exactly. anything
Facebook
else
is doing the major shrinkage.
Mark Zuckerberg said it's going to be a year of austerity.
And flatter is faster is the new work facts.
Besides firing 10,000 people, they're not going to fill 5,000 open jobs. So it's really head loss of 15,000. So that's a
they had hired 15,000 in the pandemic, but now they're going back to pre-pandemic, I think, level.
Yeah, well, if they don't fill those 5,000, they fire 11,000 more. They fired 10,000 in the fall, so that's 457,000. That's a huge number of people that won't be there.
And I come back to Eugene Rochko. When he was at our summit, who said, and I said this last week, that the total investment to build, and it ain't 3 billion people, it ain't Facebook, but Mastodon's pretty amazing, $500,000. And one person, he just this week hired his first employee.
Incredible.
Here from teenyabode.com is a picture of Elon Musk's tiny house. It's a casita.
It's a trailer
from Boxables. This is
those are so nice. We saw them at CES.
Did you? It's a prefab tiny house. Awesome. It's for a guest house on his property. Wait a minute, Elon has. I thought he got rid of all his properties.
No, he was living in like somebody's mansion.
I thought he was
in
couch surfing
Austin.
Yeah,
he was couch surfing in like Rob Roy and places like that. So.
A look inside Elon's $50,000 prefab tiny house he uses as a guest house in Texas, where he threw a birthday party there. 375 square feet, bathroom, one bedroom, living room, and kitchen. What? Okay. It's a little tight, but you know what? I could live in there. Except for the industrial door. I feel like...
You wouldn't, but you could.
I could.
The industrial door. What are you talking about?
Doesn't this look like, I mean, look at this door. This looks like
that was my exact front door on my old house that we designed and built ourselves.
Never mind. I love that door.
We had two of them.
Don't you?
It was beautiful.
Okay.
We spent so much money on it.
Really?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You know, you wanted people to be looking the door, like you coming up to the door and they see
you? Couldn't see into the house. We had, it was like a little alcove area.
Oh, okay.
We designed the house.
Clever. So that you could have a clear door.
Yeah. It was awesome.
I do like this, the pocket door or whatever you call that, that open up and give you like a patio, a little kitchen. It's pretty cute. You probably don't want the shower.
That sink. I hate those sinks.
Oh, I do too. What's the point of that sink?
You know what I hate? I hate rain showers. I despise
rain showers. Lisa hates rain showers.
I do too.
Oh, we have one of these sinks in our guest bathroom, but I didn't put it there. That's just how it came. But I agree with
you. Yeah, we have one.
It's a little bowl that sits on top of the counter instead of being sunk into the counter.
They're awful.
You could never get water under things, and it's terrible.
Well, and they're just, everything splashes, and they're just annoying. I hate them.
It's called a sink. It should sink into the counter.
It should sink.
Exactly.
I don't mind it. It's the guest bathroom. I don't want guests to be too comfortable.
It's my sink in my bathroom,
yourself at
so
home.
I hate it.
Yeah, no, in our bathroom, it sinks into this thing. Look at the little closet. You can't have any long clothes, just short clothes.
Well, who wears long clothes anymore?
I wear dresses. What the heck?
Yeah, wow. They couldn't put a dress there. It would drag. And my capes wouldn't fit. None of my capes would fit in there. I had a brief moment when I thought I should wear capes.
Let's bring back capes.
I appreciate
that.
I don't know why. When I was a kid, like in high school, I wore a big black cape, and I thought it was pretty fun. And I thought, so a couple of years ago, I went out.
These days, they think you're going to shoot up the high school. Jeez.
I bought two. Well, so that's why I bought them in purple. One of them, and I was worried it was stolen
valor. A cardinal
of
the church?
Yeah, one of them was a West Point cape, and I didn't want it to be stolen valor, so I made sure it didn't have any insignia on it, but it was just perfect. It was a really nice cape, the kind that they would wear at West Point and dress, because it had, anyway. And then I got another one, I can't remember why. You know what? I'll wear it next week. I'll wear my cape.
Yeah, do, yes.
My mom, who watches this show religiously.
You need to do that full swing of it.
Yeah, like Zorro. My mom, who watches this show religiously, will remember my cape phase in my youth. And she'll be, I don't know how
she'll
feel.
Mom, you watch the show? I didn't know that.
Oh, she loves this show. She said, I love Stacy. I love Jeff. I love Aunt. Aww. She's like, we're her family now.
Well, we indeed.
We didn't hear your name in there. What's going on, my friend?
She didn't say anything about me.
Hello.
She didn't say, oh, you're so good or anything like that. So
maybe everyone should wear a cape on this show. Just for your mom.
I bet you have a cape. I think you've worn it.
I have two capes.
You've worn it, I believe.
Oh, no, I've never worn a cape. Oh, no, I wear shawls. No, I have a full on. I have a fancy wool cape for going to like the opera.
If you live in the Pacific Northwest, it's appropriate to have a cape. Or if you're Batman.
I think a lot of people. Okay, I was going to say, I think a lot of people get along without one just fine. And then my mom made my child a cape.
I will wear. I will do a fashion show next week. I will either wear, I'll bring both capes and you can decide what you like better. One is quite expensive and has frogs. You know those, you know what they are.
Oh, yeah. I have them on, it's not on this. Did you know? Okay. No one will care about this, actually. Never mind.
I will.
Because men don't wear cardigans.
Care. Go ahead.
So, like, all my cardigans don't have
buttons. Where are the buttons? How do you
I know. Like, what the heck?
How do you join them together?
When you're cold, you need to close your cardigan.
It's not a cardigan without a button.
I don't know.
So do you have a belt?
I got frogs. I bought on Etsy, like, they clip onto your cloak, and you just, it's a frog closure, and you just close it over, and
perfect.
Then suddenly.
That's what you need.
It's like a button.
Yeah.
It's perfect. It was only $16. I love Etsy.
John says, from now on, we're going to call you Stacy Two Capes Higginbotham.
That's fair.
All right. I want to take a little tiny, teeny time while I tine out, and then the picks of the week, and we'll run this thing in home because it is.
Into the ground. That's where we're going to run it. Into the ground.
We will get it home in just a moment. But
Stacey's
first,
hungry.
I want to tell you how important it is you join Club Twit. I mean, the Google glasses don't come cheap, my friends. If whoa, Club Twit.
What? Where did that come
without
from?
Moral panic, there would be no there Club Twit. Club Twit is $7 a month. That's all. We are now 7,000.
Club Twit is your safe space from moral panic.
It is a safe space for everyone who listens to our shows. $7 a month gets you ad-free versions of everything we do. You even get shows on the Twit Plus feed that we don't put out in public, like Hands on Windows with Paul Theroux, Hands on Macintosh with Micah Sargent, The Untitled Linux Show with Jonathan Bennett, The Giz Fizz with Dick DiBartolo, Stacey's Book Club, a bunch of other great stuff. You get ad-free versions of all of the shows. You get access to the fun Discord. And I tell you, the Discord is awesome. There's Stacey in her cape, by the way. That's great. I like it that you put the furniture outside. I think that's...
It's close, yeah. I like that.
That's where furniture begins and belongs. If you are in the club, this Anthony made this with help from Stable Diffusion, a Club Twit sticker, which only you can have. I want you for Club Twit with me as Uncle Sam. Please join us. Come in the club. All you have to do is go to twit.tv/clubtwit. We are now 7,000 strong. I think if we got to 10,000 people, I would do a jig on this table. I would do something. What should we?
Okay, folks, that's
we should think of something.
We're going to see that jig.
Yep. We should think of something because I would definitely celebrate.
You're going to shave your hair.
We're getting
wearing
close.
A cape. We're do the close. Jig wearing a cape.
No, last time I danced on the table, it broke it. John
I was going to say, how sturdy is this table?
I did the Harlem. Remember the Harlem Shake where everybody, remember that? We did a Harlem Shake in the old studio and I got up on the table in my horse mask and broke it. I think we have video, to be honest with you.
I think we've seen the
is
video
is this it?
Before.
Oh, wow. Immediately it got into the, that's quick. The club members.
Have you seen that really stupid meme? What is it? The Harlem Shake? Would somebody explain that to me?
Well, explain it to us. What are you talking about?
This week on Twit, old men discuss old
Snell, Dvorak.
Oh, this hurts my heart.
That's Rafe Needleman.
Rafe Needleman, yeah.
All
and
that
Ed Bott. Ed Bott is a floating head.
Based on what? This is a song by... it's a dance that came... Oh, why am I getting an ad for Smoosh? What is this?
I don't know, but I'm not going to try it out.
I don't want it. How do I close it? It's a takeover ad.
I mean, the latest thing is to get that little box, little X at the bottom of the box.
I'm going to use New Smosh.
And you're gone.
Now I don't
Sucker.
Know. What, why did I do that? Okay, now I'm gone. I'm gone.
What happened
so,
to the thing?
Chad's a young person.
Chad, can you help us out with this thing?
Chad Johnson, our producer.
Red-haired, wonderful red-haired Chad.
Internet, this is from 2013.
And then...
on the internet.
Yeah, exactly.
What's that?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. So... Harlem Shake is this, it's literally 8 days old. The first Harlem
See,
Shake
See, that's
video,
how on top of
this
it we were.
Weird one right here.
Okay.
Was up.
So it's this song.
You have to be in it.
Yeah, it was uploaded on February 2nd there.
Yeah, they're Power Rangers.
This
yeah.
is when we had young so people in the studio who would explain
Harlem
stuff
20
like
years ago called the Harlem Shake.
Yeah.
To a.
We know that for a fact.
To a song that was created by what this guy named Bauer.
It looks rather suggestive.
Yeah, there's always an edge of...
Hey, these guys have got issues. God.
So that was the first one.
Yeah.
And then...
So it always starts out in a normal environment. There's like an office one, right, at the Makerspace, where it's a normal environment, but there's one guy doing this stupid dance. And right. then, for some reason, it's completely unknown. Everybody's dancing. And then it's over.
You,
like
you dress
seconds,
so much better
shorts.
Nowadays.
I do. I really
dress like
look
a lumberjack.
Like a slob. What am I?
We salute you.
What am I doing there?
Do you have
your makeup's heavier, period. Too. Your contour is crazy.
Yeah. Excellent contour. So this is, I think I owe it to you, Mike Elgin. You kind of raised the tone. So here's another. You should watch because I think eventually we're going to do it here. This is another one. One guy's dancing, and then everybody starts dancing.
And then the drop happens in the song, right? And then they're all dancing. It baffles me why there's what is interesting about this at all.
Seizure with an iPad.
Yeah.
Now see, I saw the guy get up on the chair there.
That's pretty bad.
Nerds.
Come on, we can do better.
We got somebody behind us here doing the same thing, hoping to get attention.
That's, I think he's, it's that, that's our intern. That's Eli. He's a,
Eli.
He doesn't know any better. He's a high school student. He thinks it's a cool idea.
Yeah, he does.
And this is when we lost it. And then watch it, because I'm going to get up on the table.
Oh, no. And it's got a single bass. Isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't
want
to see this.
It's a disaster. So,
didn't get very far.
A genius.
Don't do the Harlem Shake. That's all I'm saying. Just don't do it. I am better dressed these days. I'm better mannered. I don't get up on the table. Hey, everybody. It's Leo Laporte, the founder and host of many of the Twit podcasts. I don't normally talk to you about advertising, but I want to take a moment to do that right now. Our mission statement at Twit, we're dedicated to building a highly engaged community of tech enthusiasts. That's our audience. And you, I guess, since you're listening, by offering them the knowledge they need to understand and use technology in today's world. To do that, we also create partnerships with trusted brands and make important introductions between them and our audience. It's how we finance our podcasts, but it's also, and our audience tells us this all the time, a part of the service we offer. It's a valued bit of information for our audience members. They want to know about great brands like yours. So can we help you by introducing you to our highly qualified audience? And boy, you get a lot with advertising on the Twit podcasts. Partnering with Twit means you're going to get, if I may say so humbly, the gold standard in podcast advertising. And we throw in a lot of valuable services. You get a full service continuity team supporting everything from copywriting to graphic design. I don't think anybody else does this or does this as well as we do. You get ads that are embedded in our content that are unique every time. I read them, our hosts read them. We always over-deliver on impressions. And frankly, we're here to talk about your product. So we really give our listeners a great introduction to what you offer. We've got onboarding services, ad tech with PodSites, that's free for direct clients. We give you a lot of reporting so you know who saw your advertisement. You'll even know how many responded by going to your website. We'll also give you courtesy commercials that you can share across social media and landing pages. We think these are really valuable. People like me and our other hosts talking about your product sincerely and informationally, those are incredibly valuable. You also get other free goodies, mentions in our weekly newsletter that's sent out to thousands of fans. We give bonus ads to people who buy a significant amount of advertising. You'll get social media promotion too. But let me tell you, we are looking for an advertising partner that's going to be with us long term. Visit twit.tv/advertise. Check out our partner testimonials. Tim Broom, founder of IT Pro TV. They started IT Pro TV in 2013, immediately started advertising with us, and grew that company to a really amazing success. Hundreds of thousands of ongoing customers. They've been on our network for more than 10 years. And they say, and I'll quote Tim, "We would not be where we are today without the Twit Network." That's just one example. Mark McCrary, who's the CEO of Authentic, he was actually one of the first people to buy ads on our network. He's been with us for 16 years. He said, and I'm quoting, "The feedback from many advertisers over those 16 years across a range of product categories is that if ads and podcasts are going to work for a brand, they're going to work on Twit shows." I'm proud to say that the ads we do over-deliver. They work really well because they're honest. They have integrity. Our audience trusts us, and we say, this is a great product. They believe it. They listen. Our listeners are highly intelligent. They're heavily engaged. They're tech-savvy. They're dedicated to our network, and that's partly because we only work with high-integrity partners that we have thoroughly and personally vetted. I approve every single advertiser on the network. If you're ready to elevate your brand and you've got a great product, I want you to reach out to us. Advertise at twit.tv. So I want you to break out of the advertising norm. Grow your brand with host-read, authentic ads on twit.tv. Visit twit.tv/advertise for more details or email us
Advertise at twit.tv if you're ready to launch your campaign now. Stacey, would you like to? That was my thing of the week. What do you got, Stacey?
Oh, mine is the opposite of this. Okay, I don't know if y'all ever y'all made me feel bad for not reading any nonfiction books.
No, never.
I was like, I do read nonfiction, so I picked up one that I really wanted to read, and it is called It's Saving Time: Discovering a Life Beyond the Clock by Jenny O'Dell. She is from the Bay Area, I believe, as a writer, and she had written about The Art of Doing Nothing was her prior book. This is kind of dense, but the idea is it's a book about how we have just become short-termist and we have all these problems.
And I
don't know if y'all ever read The Clock of the Long Now.
Yes.
Did y'all ever?
Oh, we interviewed Stuart Brand, who created it. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So, I mean, just because that's kind of it's not an update on that, but it's, again, it's all about long-term thinking, and it kind of makes you feel like it tries to put some of the problems we have, like climate change and just the stress we feel from living, again, Stacey's in her anti-capitalist phase, in a highly
communist
late stage capitalistic society where time is money and money is time and money is your worth. And so it's a really nice book, and it has a lot of good examples of wisdom of other civilizations, of other creatures, and really kind of relaxed me and made me feel a little bit more optimistic. It is kind of dense. It's not like an academic tome, but it is not like a, you'll wonder, like I found myself going back and re-referencing things and kind of making some notes.
So it's not a self-help book. It looks like a self-help book, but it's really a philosophical.
No.
It's philosophy.
It's a philosophy book.
Yeah.
I don't read self-help.
No.
I'm perfect just the way I am.
Exactly. Saving Time, Discovering a Life Beyond the Clock.
Never changed, Stacey.
By Jenny O'Dell. O-D-E-L-L. Penguin Random House. So you like it. I should read this. It sounds good.
I'm about halfway through. See that it's dense, but I like it enough.
Because who has the time,
it.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Saving Time, Don't Read This Book would be one way. Okay. Thank you. Mike Elgin.
So, I like it. And there you go. Instead of telling you about a new connected coffee maker, which you don't need it. So read this book. It's going to make you far happier than buying a connected device.
Thank you. My God, you've just saved me.
I think I see the future of Stacey's life now.
Jeff Jarvis.
He's going to go all get rid of all things. Well, I want to mention just a few things. Kotke is 25.
Kotke, the website. Not
the website.
Not Kotke, Jason. Kotke.org. Jason himself. Yes,
not
probably
Leo
twice
Kotke.
That. No.
Yes, the website is 25.
Kotke.org. Wow.
Yes, Jason's site. And then a little bit of our own history here is Gina Trapani founded Lifehacker.
Yep.
It just got sold by Go Media to Ziff Davis.
Oh, I hope she got some money out of that.
Oh, no, it was long ago. No, it was because don't forget it was Gawker Media. Gawker was bankrupt.
Oh, that's right.
It got bought by one company that got by Go and it got by another one.
Go has been slowly selling off all the Gawker pieces.
Pieces of it.
Yep.
Pieces of it. I want to mention, because we talked about this, I think 2 weeks ago or last week, we have now a report online about the Black Twitter Summit, which we held at my school.
So there's been a request that we recreate it here. Would you like to?
I think that would be extremely difficult to do. However, I was thinking about that, and I think that Meredith Clark, who's now at Northeastern, has a book coming out this year on Black Twitter.
Oh, we'll get him
she
on.
She and then. Andre Brock.
Okay.
So we get Meredith on to talk about Black Twitter. Okay. I think it'd be the best.
That would be great. That would be good. Yeah,
this,
I don't
this
think
report
we
is written by
do that
no,
whole.
No way.
We're getting all of them together and stuff. We're white people. So
Zari Taylor.
We have some black people around somewhere. We could get them to do it if it's inappropriate for me to do it.
But I think they're all off Twitter now, so that's the other problem.
Well, yeah.
Zari Taylor, who's a PhD candidate at, I think, UNC, wrote a wonderful report on it, very hard to bring together, so I wanted to mention that. And then this might nerd you out. I don't know. The color printer, I just came across this, and it's an old book about the colors to put together in printing that a guy came along and recreated as, I think, a book, but then mainly as a poster. So if you scroll down a little bit, you'll start to see this is the actual stuff about how if you do so many parts of this color to so many parts of that color,
wow,
how you got multiple colors.
Oh, that's cool.
And isn't that so? Then if you go back up to the top and go to the buy a poster, you'll see it all made as a poster.
Oh,
order a poster.
Oh, and Glenn Fleischman's got to have
it. Well, he already ordered it. It was right up his alley. But I think it's kind of beautiful.
This is from an 1892 treatise on color printing. Wow. So I didn't know they had color printing way back then.
Today, I believe it's today, is Druckkunsttag, Printing Arts Day. Across all of Germany, all the printing museums and things are, and other countries as well, are honoring the art of printing.
So nice.
I thought I would do that for the day.
It is also the Ides of March. So beware.
It is.
Do not go to the forum with your toga on. Or maybe wear something underneath.
Oh, it is the Ides of March.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Yes, it is.
I would not be joking. I would not. Mr. Mike Elgin has a thing for us.
Yes. So we had a long conversation about ChatGPT and its new innovations and about its data set. And I had mentioned that the future of this kind of technology is you supply the data set or data set is your company or something like that. So here's a real world product that you can use with great value right now called ChatPDF. So basically you plug in any PDF file into this, you upload it to this service, and then you just have a conversation with a PDF file. Now, this is really useful because many, many PDFs are highly technical. They tend to be very long. I'll just give you one small example. I have a Sony camera. Sony camera's manual comes in PDF form.
Yes.
It's a million pages.
Yes.
And you can just throw that in there and just say, well, how do I, you know, you ask it in plain language, how do I do XYZ? And it says, here's how you do it. And it also... it also kind of like documents itself. So it's like on page 52, it tells you how to blah, blah, blah. And this is great for contracts that you're going to sign, which I always do as a freelancer, for rental agreements. So many things in life come in the form of a PDF. And if they don't, you can convert them to a PDF to drop in there and have a conversation with it. It's a way to, it's not super sophisticated like GPT-4, but it's a very useful way to simplify complex documents and extract information from them very quickly.
I just put
that would
in
be nice PDF.com. For reading laws.
It's what I just put in the Supreme Court pleading Google versus Gonzalez.
Oh,
and it read it all in. What are the main points of the respondent's argument in this case? That's interesting. This would be boy for the show.
Actually, I was about to say, Leo now has no job as the guy who's summarizing stories. We'll just let this do it.
I'll just read ChatGPT. So what is this using ChatGPT? ChatPDF.com.
It is. Yep.
Wow.
I just put in an academic one for the internet book I'm working on, and it came back and it said, what are the results of the online experiment conducted by the authors? These are suggested things. Here it comes. That's, wow. By the way, the authors found only limited evidence for polarization effects by content-based news recommendation systems.
Well, thank
that's
God.
Kind of cheating thank because there is an abstract.
That's what we all read when we read those papers, right? You start out, or I go straight to the conclusion, and then I'm like, okay.
Yeah. Oh, somebody said I should put Steve Gibson's notes for security now in here.
Wow, yeah.
let me just try real quickly. This is great. Thank you.
I would do that for any of Stephen Wolfram's blog posts.
This could save me so much time. Let's see. Reset or close. All right. I am going to open up the PDF. I guess I'll browse my computer.
The other beauty of this, by the way, is I can't think of any way to abuse this for nefarious purposes.
Right.
Unlike ChatGPT itself.
Well, a student puts in a PDF of a book and gets a book report out of it by cheating, but I wouldn't call that nefarious. I would call that clever.
Right. They deserve the A.
Yeah.
Mashed Potato in our Discord said, put in Steve Gibson's show notes. Here we go. Hello there. Welcome to Security Now. In this episode, we'll be discovering various security-related topics,
including the constant appearance. This is good. Here are three example questions. What is the number one way bad guys penetrate networks, and how has it changed in the past year? Through phishing attacks. However, it's changed in the past years. Attackers are now using more sophisticated and targeted spear phishing attacks. Why did Sony bring a lawsuit against the innocent nonprofit do-gooder Quad 9? Which we probably should have made a story, but if you want to know more, listen to Steve's Security Now from yesterday. Quad 9, which is a DNS provider, is sued by a record company, successfully, I might add, in Germany, because the Sony couldn't get a hold of the infringer, and so they went after the DNS provider, one of many, Quad 9, which is a nonprofit DNS provider, and they won. The DNS provider has to block. Quad 9 maintains that Sony's request essentially amounts to content censorship and risks cracking the foundations of a free and open internet in Europe and potentially worldwide. This is good. I finally understand security now. Thank you. Thank you, Mike. And it's free, chatpdf.com.
.com.
Wow. That is really cool. We're going to see, this is, you know, yesterday and the day before I was preparing for our show today, going through stories, and I just stopped.
You prepare?
Oh, God. I spent all week looking for, you can tell.
I know. I do too.
Stories, and you do too. You usually find more than me because I'm selective. Anyway, that's another story for another day. But I am looking for what we're going to talk about today. And I threw up my hands. I said, I can't. We'll wing it on AI because there's so much.
It's too big a topic. Well, that's why we need a show about that. Just that.
I think this is the show about that. I don't know if I want to dedicate a whole show to it, but we certainly will talk about it here and on Twit and on other shows as needed. I mean, we certainly talked about it on Windows Weekly today. So. Yeah. Mike, it's so great to see you. Folks, where are you going next? Gastronomad.net.
Yeah, we are going to Central America in, I think, next week and going to have a great time there. And then we're going to we're coming back here for half a day and then going to Oaxaca.
Wow.
And
we had so much fun in Oaxaca with Mike and Amira. And that's where we met our Facebook friend and a bunch of other wonderful, fascinating, smart people. And we saw so much and ate so much and drank so much mezcal. It was really a blast. Yes. I highly recommend it.
Yeah. So if anyone wants to join us for any of these things, most of this year's are sold out. But we have the Venice Prosecco experience in the fall. The first one is sold out, but the second one is not.
Oh, nice.
And we have some room in Mexico City and Oaxaca for this year. And then, of course, all of them has some availability next year as well.
Mike, can I ask you a terribly rude question?
I insist.
Just because in trying to teach students entrepreneurial journalism and such, I often mention your business there because there's other kinds of travel things people get interested in. Just trying to get a sense, is you also are writing and you're doing all kinds of things as a proportion of your upkeep.
Yeah.
How well does that do? I'm not trying to get any numbers out of you or anything like that, but is it a living? Is it a great supplement? Are you wealthy and we just don't know it?
I'm wealthy and I don't know it. No, it's none of the above. Essentially, the way we do it in our family is that the writing part is 90% me and 10% my wife, and the gastronomad part is 90% my wife and 10% me. So it's really her business. So it is kind of a living. If you were to pay her if you were to calculate what she makes on an hourly basis, it would be like $1 an hour because she just spends all of her waking hours exploring, doing all this stuff. That's kind of, is it work? Is it not work? It's hard to detect, but she makes a pretty good living and I make, a kind of a okay living and I make a kind of an okay living writing. And together we make a living. So it's really, she does okay. But again, it's very difficult because she'll spend a decade learning, exploring all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And then before we start the first experience.
The expertise.
So we have to do 10 or 15 experiences in a place before we break even.
It pays off on that. Yeah.
Yeah. So
I think what's interesting to me is that it's a combination of content, and community and expertise.
Yeah.
But it doesn't come off as traditional content, right?
No.
But certainly the visit is content. It's you bringing all kinds of value and interesting stuff to people.
And I think absolutely. The key is it's their lifestyle. It's more than a business.
Yeah.
It's right. how they live. And yeah. I think great artists and great creators, there's no distinction between their lives and their work.
There's a Google Plus dimension to this story, which is that we were doing this kind of stuff, meeting all these amazing people, being invited, lucky enough to be invited to all these incredible foodie events and wine tastings in various parts of the world. And it was Google Plus people who said, kept telling us, wow, I wish I could join you. And my wife, at some point my wife said, wait a minute, why can't they join us? What if we did what if we took the things that we might do in a 3-month period and do it in 1 week?
It is like that, by the way. It is. Yeah. It is go, go, go all day.
And so that's the idea behind it. And again, it just does not feel, as you can imagine, it does not feel like work.
Yeah. You're having a great time. Like, Amira's having a great time. Yeah. So really it's how they live. And they're able to make a living on how they live, which is great.
All right.
Stacey, do you need to get out of here or what's going on?
I was like, I have 4 minutes. I'm sorry.
Stacey on IoT.com.
I didn't tell you all this before.
At Giga Stacey. Get out of here. Stacey on IoT.com. Subscribe to her newsletter. Listen to the podcast with Kevin Toefel. She'll be back next week. Thank you. Thank you.
And next
thank
week,
you.
I want to hear about the bird, but go.
Okay. Yes. Bye.
Bye. And I want to thank you, Mike, because... You are very generous, have taken my son, Salt Hank, under your wing. He's going down to Oaxaca next month.
Yeah, which is amazing.
We are so excited about this.
I am thrilled. He's going to make a whole chapter of his cookbook is going to be about Oaxaca.
I think that when he's really experienced Oaxaca, it's going to be more than one chapter.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
But it's we're really excited about it, and we're going to have so much fun. Unfortunately, he's going to be there for a month. We're going to be there for the first week.
That's plenty.
We have to run and do another thing.
But that's fine.
We'll introduce him to everybody we can during that week. So we're really looking forward to this.
Yeah. I think that's completely fine because it really needs to be him on his own anyway. And you're introducing him to Chef Alex Alejandro Ruiz, who's the greatest chef and ambassador of Oaxacan cuisine in the world. And he's going to be, Henry's going to, this is fantastic. He is so grateful, and I am so grateful. Thank you. And in return,
it's our pleasure.
Let me plug your son, hellochatterbox.com. This is where you go. You heard Mike talking about this smart speaker that teaches AI literacy to kids.
That's right. It's a kit. You build the smart speaker using cardboard and included
electronic components.
Oh, they're
doing art now, too. That's awesome.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Oh. And ChatGPT is... coming soon. But kids, the important thing is that it demystifies AI. So they build the smart speaker, and then it doesn't do anything until they teach it specific skills. And it potentially it can do more than an Amazon Echo or that Siri can do. It can turn on the light, it can do a million things, but it only does the specific individual skills that kids teach it, and they can teach it 3 skills, they can teach it 3,000 skills. It's up to their imagination, and it uses AIs. It teaches them computer science knowledge, STEM skills, language skills, because you have to articulate. It's a speech conversation, and you design the conversation as the user. And so it's just a brilliant thing, and he's putting in a lot of schools now. He's in hundreds of schools now. So it's really a educational revolution. He believes, and I believe it too. And so, you can also buy it as an individual, but it might be showing up in a school near you. So
cool. Hellochatterbox.com. Thank you, Mike. It's so great to see you.
And thank you for that. Great to see you too.
Have a wonderful time. What country you're going to next? You said, Central America?
El Salvador is the next country we're going to, and we're going to, Kevin and Nadia and Alex are going with us, and so we're all going to go spend some time there.
That's where Amira was born, so it's her native
land.
That's
right.
Yeah.
She has cousins and stuff and aunts and so on there, so it's a cool place, and so we're looking forward to that. That's next week.
Fun.
Yay.
Have a wonderful time. Thank you so much
for
being here. I really appreciate it. It's always great to see you, Mike. And
thank you for having
your
me.
Help
appreciate
with Henry.
It.
I really appreciate that.
It's our pleasure.
Jeff Jarvis, thank you for being here, you old...
The longest goodbye.
You old coot, you. Jeff is the director of the Town Night Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of New York.
Reminds me, I got to call Craig.
Buzzmachine.com. He's on Mastodon Social at Jeff Jarvis. Do you spend any time posting on Twitter anymore, or is that you split your time?
A little bit, mainly headlines. I just put them in both places.
I have to say, I had to use Twitter to keep up on ChatGPT. It really was happening mostly on Twitter.
Oh, interesting.
Same thing with Silicon Valley Bank, because only on Twitter was Jason Calacanis tweeting with his hair on fire.
All in caps.
So I've had to visit, but I leave no trace. I am like a ghost. I move in. I go in and I leave without saying hello to anybody. Thank you all for joining us. We do This Week in Google every Wednesday. I hope you'll join my mom and make it a weekly thing. She loves
it. Hi, Mom.
She loves it. Just go to, if you want to watch live, it's Wednesdays from about 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern term. Thereabouts. And now, of course, because we're in summertime here in the U.S., we have to say 2100 UTC. The live stream is at live.twit.tv. There's audio and video. Chat with us in IRC at irc.twit.tv. In Discord, if you are a Discordian, a club member, you can also get copies of the show after the fact. Oh, boy. Big news just breaking. Thank you. The Biden administration demands TikTok be sold. Ah! Wow, I didn't know we had a breaking news thing. I like the lo-fi Stacy.
Stacy's typing, right?
Yeah, I like the lo-fi. Thank you.
I asked for it, and we get it.
Is that Anthony Nielsen? Who
is it? Is it Anthony?
Breaking. Yeah, that again. That was awesome. Ladies and gentlemen, this just in. Breaking news. It's Stacy. That's fantastic. The Biden administration, this just came in minutes ago, demands that TikTok be sold or risk a nationwide ban. This is from NPR. It is unclear whether federal officials have given TikTok a deadline to find a buyer. Regardless, a major escalation.
The journal says threatens ban if they don't sell.
Wow. Okay. I bet you will be talking about that next week.
I hope you
will stop by. On-demand versions of the show at twit.tv/twig. You can also watch us on YouTube. There's not only a live stream during the show, there's an after-the-fact YouTube version on the This Week in Google feed. There's also, of course, the best way, probably on every podcast catcher, every podcast player, just search for Twig. You should find us very quickly. Subscribe. You'll get it the minute it's available. Thank you, everybody, for being here. Have a great week. I'll see you Sunday for Ask the Tech Guys. And we'll see you next week on This Week in Google. Bye-bye.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? I am Ant Pruitt, and I am the host of Hands on Photography here on Twit TV. I know you got yourself a fancy smartphone. You got yourself a fancy camera, but your pictures are still lacking. Can't quite figure out what the heck shutter speed means? Watch my show. I got you covered. Want to know more about just the ISO and exposure triangle in general? Yeah, I got you covered. Or if you got all of that down, you want to get into lighting, you know, making things look better by changing the lights around you. I got you covered on that too. So check us out each and every Thursday here on the network. Go to twit.tv/hop and subscribe today.